STR Podcasts and Radio are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Oh, this isn't going to be about Jesus, is it?
Now, that's one of the openings I actually love. That's great. Hello, friends. It's Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. And sure, I'm glad that you joined me today. Yeah, probably will be about Jesus at some point or another. But that's all right. We try to be as thoughtful and careful as we can in talking about such an important individual. The show is Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel, your host here, and I look forward to talking to you at some time during our three-hour broadcast on anything that's dealing with ethics, values, and religion. By the way, you won't be able to talk. Actually, it won't be 3 hours. It'll be 2 hours because the last hour I have a guest who you will want to listen to, because when issues of textual criticism and things of the like, the authority of the Bible, and those things kind of come up, and they come up a lot, I refer to his works because he's one of the best in the business. His name is James White, and he is with Alpha and Omega Ministries. He's got a lot to say about this issue. Wrote the book that's probably the best book on the King James only controversy. And there's a lot to be learned from the book that is really unrelated to the controversy proper. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in there for everybody to read. We'll be talking with him in our final hour today, and we won't be taking calls then, but we are taking calls now and for the first 2 hours. 1-800-227-5278, that's the number. Locally here, the 714 area code, 754-4150. I just stumbled there on the numbers. You know why? Because I'm looking up at the door where the photocopy of the numbers have sat for the last 20 years, and somebody put a new photocopy up there. It's there. It's different. And so it gave me pause. It was just a little unfamiliar there, though the numbers were the same. I thought, oh, my gosh, what's different about that door? You would think that I would have had this memorized, having said those numbers, how many gazillions of times over the last 20 years. But I always like the cheat sheet on the back of the door to the studio, right under the on-the-air sign that lights up. In any event, the number again. Now looking carefully at a new font, 1-800-227-5278. If you're in the 714 area code, you can simply dial direct 754-4150. And I'd be glad to talk to you about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. I was gone last weekend, and I thank you for your, what shall I say, your perseverance with me, endurance, your patience. When I am called out of town, it happens with some frequency and gives me a chance to kind of meet new people and spread the news of Stand to Reason into different places. I was last weekend in Chicago. I'll tell you about that in a moment. Yesterday, though, I was right here in Costa Mesa at the Awakening Conference at Calvary Chapel. Now, there are Calvary Chapels all over the country, but this is Mama Calvary. This was the first Calvary, and it has plays a distinctive role in my own life as a Christian, because last week, last Tuesday, I think, to be exact, would be the 28th of September, was my 37th anniversary as a Christian. It was Friday night, September 28th, 1973, sitting in my apartment, thank you, and really the applause has to go to God and my brother Mark, who persevered with me for so long in sharing his convictions with me, even in the face of a lot of rebellion on my part and a lot of resistance until the Holy Spirit began working on me. We were in an apartment on Granville Avenue in West L.A., right off of Santa Monica, right by Stoner Park, where I played tennis for hours upon end. And I bowed my head, and with my brother sitting there with me, asked Jesus to come into my life and then begin making me the kind of person he wants me to be. I'm not quite there yet. But 37 years later, I think there's been some changes that have been positive, and I'm happy to be a follower of Christ, because that's the same as following reality, if you want my view on it. And 2 weeks after that, would that be the 10th of October? I don't know. You can count the days. It was a Friday night. That's how I know it was 2 weeks later. I walked through the doors of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. the very first church I ever entered as a Christian to attend a concert there. And many of you don't realize that Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, was the epicenter of the Jesus movement. I don't know if it's fair to say that's where it all started, but I'll tell you what, this is where the concentration of activity was with Chuck Smith and contemporary Christian music, which is an industry now, actually started. Not self-consciously as an industry, but just as some rockers and rollers wanting to use the gifts they had to produce music that was relevant to that generation, and talk about their love for Jesus Christ. And I'm not sure, but I suspect that the group that night was Love Song. It's probably Tom Stipe that was giving the message. I only remember one detail really about that night, and that is that in the parking lot outside, my high school sweetheart, who at that time was no longer my girlfriend, it was my big heartache at the time, but after I became a Christian, I wanted her to know about the Lord. And my brother and I, and maybe some others, brought her to the concert, and in the parking lot, she turned her life over to Jesus Christ. And here now, some nearly 37 years later, she is still have a wonderful relationship with the Lord, and so does her family. So I have roots there in Calvary Chapel. I never attended it as a church, but it was really sweet to be able to make a contribution nearly four decades later, in the same spirit that Chuck Smith and Love Song and Tom Stipe and all the rest of those that ultimately came out of what God was doing at Calvary Chapel had actually done so many years before. So it was cool. It was really nice for me. Now, I mentioned that at the opening of the talk, and having done that, and it was my way of kind of tipping my hat to the community. Though most of the people that were there clearly were not there 40 years ago. In any event, they were part of a heritage, and I was grateful for that and glad to be there. A couple of hours later, though, I'm at our table, our Stand to Reason table, and someone came up to me with a small package in their hand and said, "This is our gift to you." It was a staffer there at Calvary Chapel that apparently had just gone into their bookstore and made a small raid, and the thing that he produced was a CD set of all of Love Song's music. It was incredible. I mean, I was just open mouth gaping because it was such a sweet gift. And I haven't listened to it yet, but I'm looking forward to those tunes taking me back 40 years nearly to that wonderful, exciting, chaotic, crazy time known as the Jesus Movement. So that was yesterday. Last Sunday, though, I was not here broadcasting. I think Melinda played a teaching or something like that last week. Because I was in Chicago, I'm from Chicago, so there's a sense in which that was a little bit of a trip into my past. And I was teaching there at a rather large church, Christ Community Church in St. Charles. It was actually my second trip there. I was there 2 years ago. And my mom lives in Chicago, and she was not able to attend 2 years ago, which I would have liked, because I don't get to see my mom very often. I'm not asked to Chicago too frequently. I'm not sure why, but maybe, you know, since I spent 20 years there or something like that as growing up, they said that's enough of Cocal. I don't know. In any event, my niece was getting married that weekend in Los Angeles. So while I was making the trip to Chicago, my mother and there's no Freudian slip there. Don't even go there, folks. Okay. My mother was making her trip out to Los Angeles, so she wasn't able to visit. This time, however, she was in Chicago, as were my sister and my brother-in-law, my sister Bonnie, and the three of them were able to attend the Saturday night service, which was really great. This is a big church. I probably talked to 3,000 to 4,000 people over the weekend, given the three services that they had. The Saturday night service was the smallest, but it was still substantial. It's a big venue. And my mother and my sister and brother-in-law all got there early, which was a good idea, you know. That means they could have easily sat in the front row, which I didn't want because I didn't want to be looking down from the podium and see them all sitting there. It made me too nervous, so I encouraged them to sit like midway in the audience or maybe a little bit back, partly because, and this was true, the music would probably be too loud for them. And they did that, and so it was a nice evening. We were able to have dinner afterwards. I talked about being an ambassador for Christ. Let me tell you about this church, though. I mentioned it's a big church with a big stage and big glamorous production values. And sometimes when you're in a church like that as a speaker, it feels, for me, more like I'm watching a performance than participating in community worship. But that was not my impression at Christ Community Church there in St. Charles. Indeed, it was quite the opposite. I thought the service was so well done, particularly the worship. Now, when I speak of these things, you know, I sit through the worship every time. And after three times through the whole worship, the same worship service, you know, it's, you can see how it might start to get a little bit old, but it didn't in my case because of the skill of the worship team and particularly the leader. Because in this case, she was actually leading worship. And to me, this means something quite particular. For example, I don't think leading worship, and maybe there'll be another opportunity where I'll talk about this in more detail, but leading worship doesn't mean simply playing Christian music. It means actually being responsible for effecting a response from the audience that is the kind of response that helps them honorably ascribe worth to their God and begin to hopefully emotionally enter into their ascription of worth to their God. By the way, they don't always go together. I think it's possible to do real worship without being deeply emotionally moved, and I think it is very possible, and indeed frequently happens, where one could be deeply emotionally moved and very little worship is going on. So, like I said, that's a different topic. But I appreciated, for one, that this leader, I can't remember her name, but she was just so good. She was vivacious. She led the group, but she didn't consume the stage. She started with a song that I knew and I happen to like. Now, she characterized it as an oldie. Doesn't seem that old to me. It was Shine, Jesus, Shine. But notice that this is a song in which there is a little bit of complexity to the words. It isn't just simple statements repeated unartistically, but there's some message there that has to do with the gospel going to the nations, which touches my heart when I think about the notion and when it's coupled with a catchy tune, if you will, that's satisfying to the soul and aesthetically pleasing. It was very easy for me to enter in emotionally to the worship very quickly. So I caught on right away. And by the way, Shine, Jesus, Shine is not about the worshiper. It is about the one we're worshiping, which makes it good, because a lot of worship songs are simply about the feelings of the worshiper. And by the way, you can figure this out. You can notice this. The way you could tell is look at the words of the worship song and see how many times the first person pronoun is used. Generally, it's a lot, which ought to give you a hint about the focus of the song. In this case, obviously, Shine is about Shine, Jesus, Shine. And let your glory, I can't remember the exact words right now, let the world be filled with your glory. It's very touching. Well, I was a mess. First stanza, I was tearing up. Second time around, first stanza, I was tearing up. I was more than tearing up. I mean, it was very touching. And same thing with the third service. So I really appreciated that it is possible to do big church with a big stage and big production values that still can, you can attend and still enter into a genuinely rich, spiritually sound, emotional experience of worshiping God by ascribing glory to him and focusing in on him and what he's doing in the world. By the way, there were no creative arrangements either. And this is another thing. Again, I'm getting on my soapbox, I think, a little bit. Worship leaders, when you say, I'm going to do an arrangement of an old hymn, I know that for you, this is probably satisfying because this old hymn is just maybe a little dry after the bazillions of times that you have performed it. But old hymns are satisfying and emotionally moving to people precisely because of the original arrangement. And when you offer new arrangements, it becomes difficult for us to follow. You're not singing the tune we know. We're just singing or we're listening to your tune. Again, and it may be a good arrangement if you were doing the piece solo. I'm not down on creative adjustments. I'm just saying if you want to lead worship, then you have to lead the people. And if the people are not following, then you're not leading. And in the cases where people do arrangements on old hymns, you know, I can't follow it because I don't know your arrangement. And for me, it takes the wind out of my worshiping sails, as it were. And I have a suspicion it does for a lot of other people as well. In any event, it was a sweet experience for me. A lot of work that day, and I have had some encounters that I'll share with you probably a little bit later. One with I kind of call her the Gaia girl. I don't really know what her religious convictions were, though. She identified herself as a hippie, and she had the symbol around her neck. It's kind of a triangle with some other scrolly things on it. I looked it up. I think it's the Lemurian awakening symbol. And those folks are channeling folks, I think. In any event, she wasn't Christian. In fact, she made that really clear to me right out of the gate. And we had what I think was a telling conversation. So I hope later on in the show I'll get into the details of that a little bit. I'll be taking your calls here in just a moment. And I can see you queuing up there, so glad to see that. 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code 754-4150. You're listening to Stand to Reason.
Greg Kokel here. You know, I'd like to sit down with you. That's right, right where you live or work, and cover a subject in depth that I think's worthy of your attention. Sound like something you'd like to do? Well, the good news is that every other month we can do just that. When you sign up to receive the latest edition of SDR's newsletter called Solid Ground. In each issue, I write about a timely issue facing Christians in the real world today. And my desire is that each issue of Solid Ground gives you the practical knowledge you need to represent your faith as an ambassador for Christ in an effective and an attractive manner. Now, some of the subjects we've covered recently have been the new atheists, a proper understanding of faith, the historical Jesus, taking verses out of context, things like that. So let's spend that time together, and I think you might just find yourself a little more comfortable when a heated or sensitive topic comes up in your family or at your workplace or maybe at your church. Call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, or visit str.org and click on the Solid Ground link on the left-hand side of our homepage and start getting Solid Ground delivered right to your door. It's free, by the way, so what's stopping you and I from having our discussion?
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Greg Kokel here giving you a piece of my mind today here at Stand to Reason.
And I mentioned that last Tuesday was my 37-year anniversary, or birthday, if you will, spiritual birthday. And I did mention my brother Mark, but I want to specifically thank him for his patience, if I didn't in the last segment, for his patience and kindness and perseverance with me. And it's really a good evidence of the effect of someone who's a family member. I mean, a lot of you have family members who are just lagging behind in this whole project, and you don't know what to do with them. And in the case of Mark, I'm sure that he had that feeling lots of times with me, but he continued to be persistent, though I don't recall him being obnoxious. He just persisted, you know, and he kept bringing this stuff up, and he'd want to talk about it with me. And there was one point that I remember quite clearly, and he said to me, Greg, the things that I'm telling you are true. Sooner or later, you're going to find that out. I just hope that when you do, it's not too late. Well, that stuck with me. And I can't say that it was in itself completely persuasive, but you've got to know that there was an impact of the calm confidence that he expressed when he said those things. And we live in an era now that some have called the postmodern era. I have too. I want to clarify. I mean, there's a postmodern impulse, a relativistic impulse. I don't believe that deep down inside people are deeply committed to postmodern ideas, but there is this impulse, and what it produces is a profound skepticism about anything that has deep meaning. They may agree that there are facts about the universe that one could know in science, but when it comes to the issues of meanings and values and right and wrong and ultimate issues, it's like nobody's willing to step up to the plate and say this is the way it is, because they're quick to get shot down a lot. But I've got to believe that inside of a lot of people is a frustration with the ambiguity of life, and that when there are those that with thoughtful conviction are willing to stand in the gap and say no, there is an answer to those questions, and here it is. And maybe you might even add some of the reasons why you think those are good answers, but even just communicating in a clear way, as Mark did, and in a thoughtful way, but with confidence, the convictions that he had about ultimate reality, certainly spiritual things, this, I believe, has an impact on the disease of ambiguity that about meaning that postmodernism breeds. We actually are human beings made in the image of God, and we cannot survive long on a diet of that. That's like junk food for the soul, friends. We are not made to imbibe that stuff. We are made to know truth. And this is why we are constantly seeking the right answers to a whole host of things. And why, by the way, we routinely condemn ignorance. Oh, well, that's ignorant. Oh, those people are just ignorant. Well, why would that matter? By the way, I owe this observation to Frank Beckwith. When we condemn ignorance, we are in fact saying that human beings are made for a particular end, and that end is knowledge. And if we don't attend the knowledge, if we don't attain to that knowledge, then we're missing something. And it's a vice because we're missing it, and that's why we call people ignorant. Or stupid, if that's your choice of words, but it's a less kind way of characterizing it. Nevertheless, we universally consider it a vice. And this ought to, I think, suggest to us then something about the nature of reality, that, if we are destined or designed for certain ends, doesn't it make sense that there might be a designer? Anyway, something to chew on. Let's get to the phone calls. Mike in Florida has called in first, so I'll take you first. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Where in Florida are you?
Pensacola.
Okay. Gotcha.
I called a couple of months ago about speaking in tongues.
Okay.
But that's not what I'm calling today. Today is,
I see psychobabble up there, so there's kind of like maybe a variation of this you want to talk about here. A variation of tongues, I mean. Go ahead. That's the bad joke. Never mind.
Okay. This one's kind of about prayer. there's a worship leader in my church that he uses God and Lord over and over and over again, and it's really bothersome and hard to focus on his prayer mm-hmm. and not count his filler words, because mm-hmm. I had a teacher in high school that would say that filler words are time wasters, and if you want to push it to the extreme when you're doing that when you're praying, I don't know if she actually said that was considered sinning, but the implication was that was more or less not the right way to pray.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question is, what's your outtake on that, and mm-hmm. how might I approach him that I don't want to, I mean, have this be an attack, but I want to...
No, of course not. And you are already in a very difficult circumstance, because if you address this directly with him, then it's going to be very... Well, of course, I don't know the man, and I don't know your relationship with him, but my presumption is it's going to be very difficult for you to address this in a way that he would not likely take it personally. It's difficult, partly because it's prayer, after all. And this is his genuine expression of his emotions, or his desires or his thoughts before God. And so who are you, Mike, to say that he should be doing otherwise? But I think you have an entirely valid point. And my way of dealing with this, you have touched on one of my I don't know, pet peeves, sore spots, whatever, with my fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. It annoys the heck out of me when I hear this kind of stuff. And I think you're entirely right. There are times when the kind of spiritual psychobabble, and I think that is an appropriate way to put it, is so thoroughgoing, it is hard to pay attention to the prayer. And I think that, and this may sound odd to put it this way, I don't even know if God entirely figures it out. And here's what I mean by that. I'm not questioning his omniscience. But when people, first of all, use the name God and Jesus as a punctuation mark, which is just what you're talking about, every time there's a pause, there's Jesus or God gets fit into the space. So much so that sometimes, did you ever notice that when invoking God or speaking to God or saying his name is a natural part of the flow of the prayer, then the punctuation mark afterwards is often the same word. So in other words, if your punctuation mark is, okay, God, and thank you, God, for all the things, God, and God, I really appreciate God, and, you know, using it as a punctuation mark, and then you use a phrase that naturally has the word God in it, sometimes you'll hear God, God.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, God is the word, the meaningful word, and then the next God is the punctuation mark.
Yeah, I mean, you don't talk to normal people like that. If you're talking to Tim, hey, Tim, how you doing, Tim? I'm doing fine, Tim, and this and that. What?
I know. And here's, I think that people have been socialized to do that. That is, they learn to pray by listening to other people pray, and they pick up the cadence. Now, I have made it as a ironclad rule never to pray that way, first of all. And secondly, I think it is the responsibility of spiritual leaders to teach the people that are under them not to pray that way, but rather to pray in a way that communicates something meaningful. I mentioned a moment ago, Mike, that I don't even know if God can figure it out. And what I meant by that is, I don't think that in a lot of the prayers that people pray, that they intend very much meaning in their prayers. So they say, oh, God, thank you, be with us today, and please bless our efforts here today. Now, I think that there is a general, a very vague intention that is expressed there, and certainly God will know exactly what the vague intention is. But what specifically do they want God to do? When they say, God, be here today, he's not going away, you know? Bless us, now make something good happen. Okay, well, what specifically did you want to see happen? Do you want people's minds to be changed? Do you want them to be exhorted to a certain type of living? Do you want them to see a new idea in a different way? You know, there are lots of different things that might be in mind there. And my recommendation to people is say that rather than this general term that's so ambiguous it has almost no meaning in it. And so there's almost nothing for God to respond to. And if that's the case, then I think the prayer is not a sin, but it's largely wasted effort because there's nothing there.
With regards to your individual friend, that's a judgment call. You know, again, it depends on how well you know him, the relationship and everything, but I think it would be, you know, it may be the right circumstance, it may or may not be, to say something to him about it and say, you might say that, you know, I'm distracted a lot by your prayer, but you probably don't realize this, but you put the word God in there so many times that that's all I end up hearing. And I wonder if you ever thought about maybe trying to word your requests in a different way. And then start off the conversation that way. I don't know. Keep in mind you are taking a risk. But incidentally, Mike, I actually have instructed my own staff on this issue. And so when we pray, we have rules, so to speak, or guidelines, I should say, in our prayer time. And it's a three-point guideline. The acronym SIP, SIP, outlines it. And some of this I got from J.P. Moreland. So the S stands for specific. The I stands for intelligibly. And the P stands for persuasively. Now, these recommendations came from J.P. because what he did is he went to the Scriptures and he looked at prayers in the Scriptures. And he noticed that the people in the Scriptures were not praying, "Your will be done." Oh, Jesus did in Gethsemane, but that was only because he already knew what God's will was to go to the cross, and it was an act of surrender. But with regards to actual prayer, Paul says, make your request known to God in Philippians, and we see that kind of thing oftentimes in prayers that are recorded in the Scriptures. So they are specific, they are intelligible, and this is where we rule out the psychobabble, and they are persuasive. In other words, the people praying the prayers, in many cases, give the reasons why God should respond to their prayers. You see this a lot in the Old Testament prayers. So these are our guidelines, and we in our prayer time, and as a group, there isn't all of this other psychobabble that that some people put other people through. Now I realize, you know, people are praying genuinely, but I can appreciate that, but maybe when we address our sovereign with requests, it might be a good idea to be mindful of the way that we speak to him. As you said, Mike, we wouldn't speak to other people like that, especially people that are our superiors, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, as to the specific thing, with your friend, you're just going to have to navigate that one on your own. But just be tender towards him if you choose to approach this, because this is personal, and yeah.
You mentioned whenever, JP, are there any authors or any books or any, I don't know, talks or papers?
I don't know anybody else who talks about this at all, but I think that the advice of SIP, based on the example of biblical prayers, is sound advice and plenty authoritative. Because when you go through the biblical prayers, you don't see all of this other stuff. And so I encourage people to speak very clearly and very precisely about what they want, as if they were talking to someone intelligent. Fair enough?
That is.
All right, Mike. Good talking to you again.
Thank you so much,
okay.
Greg.
Take care. We got a few moments before the break. We'll go to another call here in New York City. Sean, hello. Is that Sean or Dean?
It's Sean.
Sean, okay.
You?
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. By the way, I first want to say you're just been a wonderful strengthening of my faith.
Great.
It's been terrific.
Great.
Here's my question. It's sort of a convoluted question, but I read your debate with Michael Schumer.
Shermer, yeah.
A while back.
Right, uh-huh.
And, by the way, I was not at all convinced by even his reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
But what occurred to me is, how does somebody who believes in evolutionary morality of some sort explain away something like Nazi Germany? How can they not say that, you know, if that was some sort of new evolutionary pattern, how do they say that that's not good? And how, if that were to happen again on a wider scale of some sort, how could they say it wasn't good if it was evolutionarily derived?
This is a problem, I think, that they face. And one difficulty is, I do not think that materialistic evolutionary types, when talking about morality, are thoughtful about the problem that they're facing, okay? I think that there are some clever moves that they have made with trying to account for certain behavior that we consider benevolent or altruistic, and show that the altruistic behavior really is behavior that is meant to get one's genes into the next generation. And so you can account for altruistic behavior based on kind of a selective agent. So if we could say...
Isn't that selective already when they're all just saying we're dealing with the altruistic behavior instead of all behavior?
Well, I'm not sure I understand that point.
Well, you're talking about them describing how altruistic behavior gets passed on to the next generation.
Right.
But what about abusive, horrendous behavior?
No, that's part of the problem. No, I'm with you on that. I think that's exactly what they have to confront. I was trying to kind of give them their due, give them their propers here with regards to this particular conversation or contribution, but then realizing that you have to then say the same thing about all these other behaviors, that for some reason these evil behaviors continue to keep showing up. And there doesn't seem to be the slightest diminution of that over time, as you would expect if evolution were true. And so this takes the Darwinian, you know, macroevolution picture, the neo-Darwinian synthesis. So this then takes me back to a question about how these traits are passed on. Because if we're going to say that what we call goodness is a genetic thing that is favored by evolution, then what we call badness would have to be just the opposite. That is a genetic thing that is not favored by evolution. But clearly, all the badness genes keep getting passed on. And so when it comes to evolution seems to be favoring both things, so you cannot then define good in evolutionary terms, because its opposite can just as easily be defined in evolutionary terms as well. And I think that's the point you're hitting on, and I think that is devastating for any attempt that they would make to try to characterize morality by some kind of Darwinian evolutionary natural selection process.
In that particular debate, I didn't see anything that covered this particular topic, like how they would try to defend against it.
No, you're right. No, it didn't happen in that debate. And what I was going to say a moment ago is that is just one of the legion of difficulties of trying to use the Darwinian processes to make sense of morality. I spent the majority of my time in the debate pursuing a different point, which, you know, God bless him, Michael Shermer never got. And that is, if we are talking about morality, we are describing something that is, well, like rape is wrong. The only meaningful way of taking that is that the wrongness is a quality of the rape. And that is wherever the rape goes, the wrong quality follows it. You know, the property of wrongness follows it. It cannot be a property of the individual. That's what relativism is. But evolution only allows for properties of individuals with regards to morality. In other words, morality is a reaction or response or a judgment I make in a circumstance because my genes have required that. But that's not morality. That's not objective morality. That's relativism. And he continued to deny that he was a relativist. He affirmed that he was an objectivist and then kept characterizing morality in relativistic terms. And he never got it. He never saw the problem. So that's the way it went there. There were a lot of different directions that one could go, I think, to showing this difficulty. And you've hit on one of them. And I really need to use that argument more frequently here, because if evolution can account for goodness, then what accounts for all the badness that's still around, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you exclude badness from the evolutionary pattern. I mean, to say that only goodness evolves, you have to have a mechanism for that.
Yeah, exactly.
There is
none. By the way, that the mechanism can in Darwinism, as you know, can only work on material stuff. It works on the genes, and it selects for certain genes. Do we want to say that one's kindness, as opposed to one's, well, I would say one's a person's kindness to another person is simply a genetic characteristic, and therefore someone's evil actions towards someone else is just a variation of genes, that goodness is something like the color of one's eyes? I think it's obviously different, and indeed, if it were determined by genes, then as a determined thing would not be subject to the dictates of morality. Because if it's determined, there's no choices involved. Your genes dictate it, but morality just seems to be the kind of thing, that is, the morality that needs explaining just seems to be the kind of thing that entails a choice where you could do one thing rather than the other, which is why we feel justified in praising people who do good and blaming people who do bad and even punishing them. None of this makes any sense in the Darwinian characterization.
I suppose another silly way to look at it is, if goodness is genetic but nothing else, then all the bad things we do is somehow our choice. So we could only choose to do bad things because the good thing's genetic.
Well, no, I think I would put it that not only would the good things be genetic, but the bad things would be genetic too. Everything's genetic, and therefore there is no genuine choice. And if there is no genuine choice, it's hard to imagine how there can be genuine morality, which is why I say if you're a Darwinist, then you don't really believe in morality. You just believe in behaviors that we mistakenly think are good or bad. And this is what the philosopher Michael Ruse, who himself is an atheistic Darwinist, has said very clearly. And we cited him, Frank and I, in our book on relativism, that if you're a relativist, I mean, if Darwinism is true, then there is no morality, period. Got to run here. Sean, thanks so much for the call. Going to break here and then back with more of your calls here on Stand to Reason.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, and boy, am I excited to offer you my new book, Tactics. It's a book that I wrote to help you discuss your Christian convictions with non-Christians. And it outlines specific steps to follow that you can take that will help those conversations be less intimidating and more effective. And we've seen a tremendous response to this book, and many people have already told me how much it will help them. And I hope it will help you too. To get a copy for yourself or as a gift, simply visit tacticsbook.com. It's my aim to help you make a difference for the kingdom with this book. To order your copy, simply visit tacticsbook.com.
Are you tired of searching for reliable information on current issues of interest to Christians? Like why Jesus is the only way, same-sex marriage, evolution, and atheism, and then wading through pages of entries without finding what you were looking for? Well, I think I can help you with that today. Next time you start to Google that topic that has you searching, why not give str.org a chance first? At str.org, you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the many issues that challenge the Christian thinker in today's world. Take a few moments to browse str.org to find topics ranging from ethical issues like embryonic stem cell research to the theological debate about faith and works, and everything in between. I'm convinced you'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. It is also the place to learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth of your convictions. And while you're there, don't leave without signing up to receive our free monthly resources, Solid Ground and Greg's Personal Mentoring Letter. Both of these are written to encourage you and help you to grow more effective as an ambassador. They are free, and by signing up, you'll have complete access to all content on str.org. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.
Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind here on Stand to Reason. As I do every Sunday from 2 until 5, if you don't get to listen to the whole show, just go to str.org and download the podcast. You can also do it from iTunes. Incidentally, we were just talking about the issue of morality and evolution. I think this is an intractable problem for Darwinists. And as I said, I think they have made a good old college try in trying to make sense of some of these things. But I think the difficulty is at is so deep that it is not possible for them to rescue genuine morality based on the Darwinian project. Darwinism is materialistic by definition. Morality has to do with values and obligations, right and wrong, virtues and vice, which by definition are not materialistic things. Behaviors are physical. Whether or not the behavior is right or wrong is not a physical thing. And the best we could say is that evolution has tricked us into believing some things are good because in believing they are good, some procreative advantage befalls the organism. By the way, it would have to be human organisms in this particular case because none of the other animal kingdom has the least bit of interest in morality. And the entire animal kingdom has been able to survive just fine without it. But I have another question, and I have not really developed this. I've thought about it a lot, but I've never developed it publicly. I just want to introduce it now before I get to some of the other callers because I think this is a this is a fruitful avenue to pursue to reflect on another difficulty here with morality and Darwinian evolution, and that is what is evil? What is that? And what is good? Now, I think that we could say with regards to a mutation that a mutation is good, and here we're just talking about generalized materialistic sense, a mutation is good if it confers an adaptive element to the individual creature that allows them to get their genes into the next generation more effectively. Okay, well, I mean, that strikes me as just standard Darwinian doctrine. Is any adaptation or change good or bad? Well, it's good if it allows the organism to survive better, survival of the fittest, and it's bad if it doesn't. So good and bad have very functional terms there. Now, if this is correct, then thinking about life across the board right now on the planet and all the variations that we see, how many of those variations, all the adaptations that are collected now in the huge living genome, all right, all of the minute characteristics of every living thing, allegedly adaptations that allows them to survive a little better and get their genes into the next generation, how many of those are good according to an evolutionary definition of good? Well, the answer would have to be that every single one of them are good, or at least neutral, because all of those organisms are surviving and reproducing under the present set of environmental conditions. So by a Darwinian assessment, all current physical qualities are good in the sense that, and in the only sense that Darwinism can call them good, they confer a reproductive advantage. Anything that was not good was not good because it did not confer a reproductive advantage, and in so doing would cause the thing to die out and go extinct. So the extinct things had bad physical characteristics in the Darwinian sense, and all of the things now alive have good ones for this current environment. Now, I just want you to see something. Do you see on the Darwinian characterization of things that nothing that currently exists can be called bad? So when it comes to Darwinism explaining morality, how could any bad, morally bad things exist? Because a morally bad thing would be something that did not confer a reproductive advantage, and a morally good thing would be something that did, and everything that's alive right now has adequate reproductive advantage in the present circumstances, so nothing could be bad. My conclusion is then on that view, no action could be called bad based on the evolutionary characterization, but there are plenty of bad things that people readily acknowledge, and therefore the evolutionary characterization is not adequate to explain it. Think about that one. By the way, I would love to have that transcribed, that this little section I offered, and because maybe that'll show up in print somewhere. Let's go to Natalie. Find your button there. Natalie, welcome.
Hi, Greg.
Hi there.
Really good to talk to you. I really appreciate all the wisdom that you share with all of us.
Thank you. Thanks.
My question is just, I've been to a lot of prayer meetings, and you know, we pray and we repent a lot on behalf of our ancestors or our previous sins or our nation. And I just want more, like, clarity on it or any scripture references you have for it to help me understand how this works a little bit.
Sure. There is a precedent for this, and the precedent is in Daniel chapter 9. And here I'm going to cross-reference the famous or maybe infamous Jeremiah, is it the 29 passage, I know the plans that I have for you. In that chapter, God, through Jeremiah, is telling the exiled nation of Israel, those in captivity in Babylon, that they will be in exile for 70 years. And then when the 70 years are up, they will return. And Daniel is one of the first deportees. He's a kid. And we read about, you know, the development of Daniel in the book of Daniel. But in Daniel chapter 9, Daniel's an old man. He then takes counsel from the prophecy of Jeremiah, which he has in his possession, because it was a letter written to the people in exile. And he notes that the timetable has been resolved if the 70 years are up. And in the first part of Daniel 9, Daniel prays a prayer of repentance for the nation. And this is something that God honors, and there's a, you know, a wonderful vision that is given him, and the famous 70 weeks prophecy occurs after that. But I think that there must be some legitimacy to individual godly people standing in proxy for the rest of the people in prayer before God, because Daniel does it there. I'm not entirely clear in my own mind the extent of that, and it may be, for example, that this only makes sense in light of the nation of Israel because of their unique covenant relationship with God, and I don't know if this is going to work for any other nation.
Uh-huh.
Now, when the deportees went to Babylon, God did tell them to pray for the prosperity of their nation. In other words, unpack your bags, settle in, and become members of that community and pray for their prosperity. So there is a legitimacy there of praying for the prosperity of one's nation, even if the nation is godless like Babylon was.
Yeah.
So I think there is some legitimacy to this based on those two things. I don't know the extent of it. It's always legitimate to pray for any good thing.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, that's open-ended, I think. Make your requests be made known to God, Paul says in Philippians, I think. And so, whether there's some kind of magic, if you will, or some kind of a special authority, maybe a better way to put it, some obligation that God has regarding prayers prayed by godly people in identification with their godless country, that I'm not so sure of. I mean, if that's
right.
If that's the particular dynamic that's being invoked. And the only way to answer that question is to peruse the scriptures and to see what other examples do we have that are positively given of that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think that was my confusion is I understand, especially when we're covering, like, important subjects or abortion, like, I understand praying on behalf that, you know, this will end and the importance of that, but it's like when I feel like, you know, you're asked to repent on behalf of your generation, it's kind of like, well, it just seems like there's a lot of responsibility, though, on the individual to God in repentance, so I'm not sure if I could do that.
No, I'm with you on that, and though Daniel does offer a prayer of repentance for the people, I think it's fair and at least, and not only fair, but obligatory for us to first acknowledge the unique kind of relationship that God has with Israel in virtue of very particular covenants, Mosaic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, Davidic covenant. I mean, Israel is special. And so we can't just grab something and move that's pertaining to them and then just move off willy-nilly because we fancy ourselves now as the people of God and we can purloin their promises, as I've said in the past.
There
may be some application, but simply because Daniel does it on behalf of Israel does not mean that we can do it on behalf of the United States. That would be my take. We have to do some more study first before we can find that out.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Good talking to you.
You too.
Natalie, I appreciate your call. And Twitter winner for this hour, Peter Freund. This name sounds familiar. Has he been a winner in the past, or has he sent some things to us, a Facebook friend? Okay. Congratulations to you, Peter. You will get Relativism CDs, including the CD in which I cover the issue of monkey morality. Can evolution explain ethics? What we've just been talking about. I'm Greg Kokel. Hour number two just ahead. Don't go away. My friends, Greg Kokel here with you on Stand to Reason. And I'm looking forward to dialogue, education questions, debate, interaction here about the most important issues of life, ethics, values, and religion. That's what we always do here at Stand to Reason. And of course, you can participate by calling me. We have some people in the queue already, but if you'd like to dial up 1-800-227-5278, I'd be glad to talk with you. Hour number two here, that is in the 2 hours that are left in our show, I'll have James White with me here talking about the King James Only controversy. He's written the book on the issue. He might be called the King James of the King James controversy. And he's one of the guys I turn to whenever I need some really thoughtful, carefully done scholarship on issues of textual criticism and transmission of the Bible. And the book that he's written is probably the best book that you can possibly get on this issue. We'll be talking about that in our final hour today. In the meantime, we'll be taking your calls, of course. And I mentioned at the beginning of last hour, and incidentally, there was a lot of things that we talked about last hour with callers and just my opening comments that you may want to catch. I especially had, I think, an interesting call that's important that dealt with the psychobabble during prayer and also the issue of evolution and morality, both things that were worth talking about. And if you go to str.org and download our podcast, you'll be able to hear our comments on that. That'll be up probably by tomorrow afternoon. Last weekend, I wasn't here, as many of you know. I was in Chicago, and I was teaching at two different churches on Saturday night and Sunday morning. I had a chance to reprise an appearance at one of the largest churches in the area. The church is Christ Community Church. I probably talked to, as I mentioned last hour, 3,000 to 4,000 people there. I was thrilled to do so. I had a great experience. The worship was sensational. I've already talked about that. I did mention last hour something I want to get into more detail on this hour, and that is a conversation that I had with a young lady that was distressed about something that I said. Now, my talk that day was about being a good ambassador. And in that talk, I have a section where I relate a conversation that I had with a hippie back in 1974. Now, I used the word hippie nostalgically, because, as I said, everybody during that time here in Southern California was a hippie, except for some hippies had religion, and those hippies with religion were called Jesus freaks, and that was me. And we all had long hair, even me, which is hard to imagine. But I talked about how I had really been unkind in the way that I communicated my convictions to him, and I have since reformed my ways more or less, and that was the point of the illustration. But I was clearly saying that the hippies' rejection of Jesus and the things that Jesus offered was a mistake, and that his contrary view to mine was wrong, which was why I was evangelizing him. And afterwards, I was standing out in the library, the lobby by our book table, and a young lady came up to me. I think her name was Shannon. She introduced herself to me. I noticed that hanging from her neck was a pendant. It was a triangle, like a pyramid, and it had some scroll work in it. And I did some search on the internet, and I think if I found the same symbol, this is a symbol that relates to Gaia and occultic issues and the like. In any event, she introduced herself as a hippie. And in other words, someone who shared maybe the same ideas as this person, and somebody who's hip now in the kind of earth religion Gaia sense that a lot more and more people seem to be embracing. So she wasn't nasty or she wasn't mean, but she wanted to let me know her sentiments. And she began to explain rather matter-of-factly that she believed in respecting other people. And this was the concern that she had with Christians. Now, I immediately said, well, I believe in respecting other people too. I just wanted her to know that that was part of my value system, but you need to know, and I certainly was aware of it in the conversation, that when someone else raising an objection to us evangelizing others raises the respect issue, this phrase respecting others is a term of art in the relativistic system of things. What they mean by respect is not simply that you accord the person with whom you disagree a significant manner of grace in the process of your disagreement, but that your act of disagreement itself is a violation of respect. That for you to say that you are right and they are wrong is in itself a violation of relativistic even-handedness. It's disrespecting the other person, and you are not being tolerant of them. Now, of course, I'm very well aware of this detail. I have seen it many times, and I knew in about 15 seconds exactly what the complaint that she was going to raise would be. And indeed, I was not disappointed. She went on to explain how, you know, Christians... she is willing to respect the views that Christians have about Jesus and God and forgiveness and being born again and having a new life and feeling like all their sins are cleansed and all of that. She is willing to allow that for us. Why won't we allow her to have her view? Now, of course, we do allow her to have it. We think the view is mistaken, and we want to persuade her otherwise, but we would, in one sense, we allow her to have it. But she that's not enough for her, because she wants us to adopt her own pluralistic, relativistic view towards religion. In other words, you can have your own convictions, but with regards to other people's convictions, you are neutral, and this neutrality is the essence of tolerance. So I asked her a question, and by the way, you have to keep in mind here. Let me confess to you. Generally speaking, I try to be gracious in these kinds of situations, and in this particular situation, I had just given a talk to over 2,000 people about being a good ambassador, and now I'm in the foyer that is filled with those same people, including one of them that's taking exception with my view. I am on my best behavior. Everybody's watching. That coupled with the fact that you know, I do think it's a virtue to be kind to people as a good ambassador, means that I was choosing my words very carefully. I learned her first name. I think it was Shannon. I used it frequently. I tried to be gentle with my tone of voice. I didn't interrupt her. I listened carefully. And then I used my Columbo tactic, and as many of you could imagine, pardon me, being familiar with the tactic itself, I then employed Columbo with suicide. Because there was a problem here. A practical suicide was in play. But I wanted to be careful not to sound like, I gotcha, because that would just have made her angry, and I didn't want to do that. And so I said, okay, I think I understand your point, Shannon. Let me ask you a question. Are you suggesting to me that I should change my approach? Now, what is the correct answer to that question, friends? The correct answer is yes. She was suggesting. In fact, she was more than suggesting. She was essentially demanding. It's just part of fair play. I'm willing to let you have your view. Why aren't you willing to let me have mine? So she wanted me to change my approach. Now, at first she said, no, I'm not asking for you to change your approach. I'm just, and then repeated her point, which was to change my approach. So when I asked her the question again, she was willing to nod, well, I guess I am willing to do that. Okay, so you're willing, what you want me to do is to change my point of view about communicating my own convictions to other people and adopt your point of view, which was the pluralistic relativistic view, the so-called tolerant view. Now I said, how is it that what you're doing right now with me is any different than what I was doing regarding your point of view and the hippies' point of view that you are objecting to now? And she says, no, you don't understand. I'm not trying to change your point of view. I'm just simply saying that you shouldn't be telling us what to do. You shouldn't be acting like we have to believe that we're wrong and adopt your view and that you're the right one. I'm here with my friends. I don't believe in this stuff. I come because they're my friends. They're Christian girls that are here, and I'm glad for them, and I rejoice for them. Why don't you rejoice in my view for me? So what she did is just covered the same ground again. And I asked the same question again because the same question applied. Are you trying to change my point of view here? No, I'm not trying to change your religion. I said, my religion is an evangelistic religion. Jesus left us with the Great Commission. Part of our religious view is that we tell other people because we think other people need to hear what we have to say. They're in danger. We're concerned about them. Or something to that effect, I went on. So are you telling me not to do what my religion tells me to do? Once again, the correct answer to that question is yes, she was telling that to me, but she didn't get it. And so we started round three, going around the same block again. I asked the exact same question, maybe using a few different words, because I wanted her to see that she was trying to change my mind. She was trying to tell me my religious view taken as a whole is false and that I should adopt at least one aspect of her religious view, that is her take of tolerance and her take of respect, and rejoice with her alternate view, just as she is willing to rejoice with aspects of my alternate view. And I asked the same question again, third time around, and when I did, she rolled her eyes, gave a huff, turned on her heel, and walked away. And when she turned, there were other people watching me, and they could see that she was starting to cry, but she was crying with tears of anger. And indeed, she walked through the group, grabbed her friends, made her way about 20 yards away, turned around, and then glared at me with angry, tearful eyes. Now, I just want you to notice a couple of things about this encounter. I have said in the past, and I've said it many times, that it is not my goal to make people angry. If I get mad, I lose. If they get mad, I lose. So I'm trying not to draw lines in the sand. I don't want to get people defending turf. I'm trying to put a stone in their shoe, but sometimes you cannot avoid it. Sometimes people get mad not at your method, but at your message. And I was not willing to back down from the truth that Jesus himself spoke and taught his disciples to say after him. And she never saw that she was doing the very thing that she was telling me not to do. She just didn't get it. Notice how she started her conversation. She started her conversation on the subject of respect. Yet her response to me when she couldn't get through to me was completely devoid of respect. As she stomped away, I said to the retreating Shannon, "It was nice talking to you." And I said it genuinely and not in a sarcastic way. But she didn't have any such parting amenities to me. For me, she just was angry. In other words, who in the conversation was acting with respect and who was not? This happens all the time. The so-called tolerant people act in the most intolerant way. Even when the Christian who is the intolerant one is comporting himself with grace and kindness. So don't be surprised when you run into the same thing. This is the face of relativism. And even though I was treating her with civility throughout, she the tolerant one, when it became clear I was not going to agree with her, treated me with scorn, hostility, and contempt. Be ready for it. I think we're going to go to break just a little early here, and then we'll come back to your calls. The number 1-800-227-5278. If you're local to me here in Orange County, 754-4150 is the number to dial for Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel here. You know, I'd like to sit down with you. That's right where you live or work, and cover a subject in depth that I think is worthy of your attention. Sound like something you'd like to do? Well, the good news is that every other month we can do just that when you sign up to receive the latest edition of SDR's newsletter called Solid Ground. In each issue, I write about a timely issue facing Christians in the real world today. And my desire is that each issue of Solid Ground gives you the practical knowledge you need to represent your faith as an ambassador for Christ in an effective and an attractive manner. Now, some of the subjects we've covered recently have been the new atheists, a proper understanding of faith, the historical Jesus, taking verses out of context, things like that. So let's spend that time together, and I think you might just find yourself a little more comfortable when a heated or sensitive topic comes up in your family or at your workplace or maybe at your church. Call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, or visit str.org and click on the Solid Ground link on the left-hand side of our homepage and start getting Solid Ground delivered right to your door. It's free, by the way, so what's stopping you and I from having our discussion?
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
The show is Stand to Reason. Get the fat out of your thinking by trimming down to fighting weight every weekend on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel here, your host, and just a postscript on my comments about what I'm choosing to call the Gaia girl, Shannon, there in Chicago. That is one of the circumstances, by the way, where I have some hope, even though she was really mad at me, because I wouldn't buy her relativistic understandings of respect and tolerance. And as you saw, as I described that, even she was guilty of violating her own definition of respect and tolerance there. She was angry at me, but, and I think as she walked away, she was so angry that she couldn't think straight. She was just really mad. But I have some confidence that regardless, even though she couldn't see my point then, I'm wondering if this is going to be one of those occasions when 2 or 3 years from now, this young lady is going to say, you know what, I talked to this guy in church once, and I gave him a really hard time. But I have since realized that he was right on this. And by the way, friends, I hope you realize that I am not interested in getting a notch in my belt here in being right for the sake of being right. I'm interested in her seeing that I'm right for her sake. And maybe many of you can think back at times when you were furious at somebody who stood properly for what is true. And as time went on, though you were mad at the moment, and maybe even expressed it as time went on, that willingness for that person to stand firm and be gracious at the same time began to eat away at you in a good way. And finally, the defenses fell, and you saw what was true. I hope that happens for this young lady. We'll see. And we'll probably not know until eternity, but that's okay with me. Let's go to Josh in Las Vegas. Hello, Josh.
Hey, Greg. Nice to be on the show. Long-time listener. Really, really glad to be on your podcast. It's the only thing that helps me survive my commute.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Do you actually live in Las Vegas?
No, I live in Los Angeles, but I go to school up at Fuller Theological Seminary right. in Pasadena, so uh-huh. I have to make that drive.
Oh, that's the commute you're talking about. Okay.
Yeah.
So what's on your mind today, Josh?
Well, I'm trying to sort through foreknowledge stuff.
Okay.
And I just kind of want your... Because what I'm trying to figure out is how there can be a logical... to peer into the future or to see future free will action.
Okay.
Because on the one hand, I believe in libertarian free will, so I believe that what I do in the future is really up to me mm-hmm. and not any deterministic forces.
Right.
But I also believe in a theory of time, so I think that the future isn't real yet. It's not there, and it hasn't happened. So it seems like, you know, if it's really up to me whether it goes one way or another, and the time hasn't happened yet, then how could there be a way for God to, like, peer in and see? You know what I mean?
No, I know entirely here. I know entirely what you're saying, and this is called the grounding problem. That is, what is it that grounds or makes possible God's knowledge of events that have not yet happened? Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of ways to respond to that. Let me just make a little correction here or a refinement for you, since obviously you've trafficked in some of these ideas before. The way you described libertarian freedom needs one more little piece added to it in order to be true libertarian, because even somebody who's not a libertarian but who is what they call a compatibilist would say that their compatibilistic freedom means your choices are truly your own. You make them. That would be consistent with compatibilism. There's an additional element that libertarian freedom entails, and that is you could have done otherwise. Mm-hmm. So that CDO condition, that could have done otherwise, is what makes libertarian freedom different from compatibilism. Yes, your decisions are your own, and you could have done other than you decided to do. That would be libertarian freedom. Now, to the question proper, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. To the question proper, then, as you pointed out on the A theory of time, The present is the only thing that exists. The past is gone. The future has not yet happened. There is a continual becoming or moving through time, the passage of time, the flow of time. And I agree with that view, by the way. Then how is it that God knows the future? And here, this is just a personal issue, but I think that the word foreknowledge is not the right word here. I think, although Bill Craig uses that term to mean God's omniscience of the future, I think that foreknowledge may have a different meaning theologically when you're used in the texts. But just to specify what we're talking about here is God's knowledge of the future, and you're using foreknowledge to describe that. How is it that God knows those things? Now, one way for God to know them is by perception. And that would be is if the B theory of time were true, which neither of us accept, and that is time is kind of like a book, and this is C.S. Lewis's illustration in Mere Christianity, that if for God time is like a book, and just like we can move from the front to the back of the book, or any place in between, we can view any point in the timeline of the story, if you will, there is no real time passing. But there is a logical order of events, a temporal, in a certain kind of order of events. Well, if God can do that, the way he knows the future, his foreknowledge in that sense, is because he can simply see the future. I mean, he beholds it because it actually exists. That's one way of grounding God's foreknowledge. If some people ground foreknowledge in light of his decree, that there is some mysterious sense in which God has decreed the events of the future, even though he is not strictly determining the free will actions of people. And that would allow him to, in a sense, know what's going to happen because he has a decisive role in causing it to happen. Be another way of grounding it. Bill Craig, I think, grounds it a little differently. I mean, if even this could be called grounding. And that is he uses modal logic or multiple worlds, possible world approaches, all of the different possible worlds that might be created, and God knows all the possibilities, and he also knows the possibilities of human freedom. That is, even though it, in any possible world, I might receive Christ or not. Those are the logical possibilities. As it turns out, given my personality, there might be some worlds in which I wouldn't and some worlds in which I would. Those are the viable worlds, so to speak. And what God chooses to do is he chooses to actualize the world in which he knows, in which most people become Christians, freely choose that. And he knows all the things in the future of the actual world in virtue of the fact that he actualized that particular world that would be that way. So, I mean, this for some, and maybe even for yourself, Josh, is starting to get a little Twilight Zone-y here. And I can appreciate that because some people might even ask Bill Craig, well, wait a minute, how does he even know all of these counterfactuals of human freedom if they haven't happened yet? So you're almost back to the first square again. To be honest with you, I can't remember how he answers that, and I don't know if I can take it any further myself. I think it's a fair question. Right. How does God know those things? Unless it's just a divine quality of omniscience that he just possesses and which he knows all of those things. It's part of his natural knowledge. He knows all possibilities, and then his free knowledge is that he knows all things that will actually take place. And I don't know how to take it any further than that. I mean, it'd be nice if I could give you this equation of some sort. Well, here's how it all works out, but I don't actually think God perceives the future because I don't believe as we might read the end of the book before the beginning, because I don't think that time is like a book like that.
That's the B theory. Like, Yeah, I feel a little stuck on all sides a little bit because I'm the same way. I don't think he could see it because of the time, but I also don't think that he decrees it because I think my future free will decisions are because I decree it.
Yeah, you know, that's
right. He actually gave me that.
That's right.
And I also have trouble with middle knowledge stuff because I'm like, how is it that what I would do is out there as a truth when I don't even exist yet? It just seems weird, you know, so it's kind of like...
Sure, yeah, because that's right, because I understand entirely. I'm going to have to ask that question to Bill sometime. In fact, I just had a flurry of emails with him because I'm writing this the last couple of days because I'm writing this thing on Stephen Hawking, by the way. But I will see him at a conference coming up in a couple of months and 6 or 8 weeks or so. And I think I'm going to try to just grab him and talk to him a little bit about that and see what he has to say. Sorry, I can't give you a more definitive answer on that. It sounds like you've covered most of the bases already without me, so...
Well, I appreciate your thoughts. And I was going to say, too, just for your listeners, or I don't know if you knew, but that Richard Swinburne is going to be lecturing here in Orange, California.
Oh, no kidding.
The 11th.
At Chapman University?
Yep, yeah, at October 11th at 7 p.m., and it's free. So anybody, you know, I think he's talking on mind-body stuff or dualism of some kind, but it's
right.
It's pretty cool.
Right. Yes, and that would he's not a young guy. So but a significant player in the in contemporary philosophy. So it might be a thing. Where could people find out more information if they wanted to attend?
Well, goodness, I got invited on Facebook. So, but I bet.
All right. Well, I think Chapman University is hosting him, they could probably go to the Chapman University website and get the information on it. You said it was in October.
Yeah, October 11th at 7 p.m.
Okay.
At the, whatever the hall, main hall is.
Yeah. Okay, October 11th, 7 p.m. I had a debate on that campus a while back with Marv Myers. It was a long time ago, but I frequently refer to it because it's an interesting debate. But I'll make a note here, October 11th, 7 p.m., Richard Swinburne at where was it? What did we say? Writing it down. What school?
In Orange, California.
And what was the school again? Chapman. That's it. Chapman.
Yes.
Chapman University. Okay.
And then also he's doing another lecture on Wednesday night. So
same place?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Hey, thanks for the call. Thanks for the call, Josh. Yeah, I appreciate chatting with you. Melinda's just giving me the skinny on this, right? What do you have? Okay. Melinda just posted the details on Twitter. So if you go to Twitter and I think our username is strtweets, you can get the information there. STRtweets. If you actually want to be interactive there, it's #strtalk for you to do that, and then you could participate with everybody else and maybe win something. So there's an idea. Thank you, Josh. Let's go to Calgary, Canada. That's Alberta and Greg. Hello, Greg. I appreciate you calling from Calgary.
Thanks. Appreciate what you do.
Thanks.
First and foremost, I was kind of having a little bit of a chuckle over this last caller and that when you were talking about the C.S. Lewis and the time, because I called him before after reading Mere Christianity, and I was all excited and everything, and then you schooled me on.
I shot you out of the water. Well, you know, you never want to take exception with C.S. Lewis without fear and trembling, but but I just, in his defense, I just don't think that he had the philosophical tools to realize what he was saying, and I only saw this because one of my mentors, who we just were talking about, William Lane Craig, actually taught a whole course on the issue of time that I took, and I was able then to be able to see the difference between the A theory and the B theory of time. And the B theory of time is the static theory, and that all time exists in one chunk. And in that sense, nothing ever happens. It's all happened simultaneously, and it's more like the story of a book. And then he used C.S. Lewis's illustration in Mere Christianity as a very good characterization of the B, which stands for bad theory of time. But I think that if Lewis were able to reflect on the kinds of arguments that that Bill has offered, he may easily change his mind. However, there are well-meaning Christian theologians and philosophers who hold to the B theory. I do want to mention they're not in good company because the B theory of time is the materialist version of time.
Yeah.
And it seems to deny what's obvious, that is that time flows.
Yep.
And the past doesn't exist, the future is yet to come, and we only have the present. So, but that's another discussion. I maybe it was a bittersweet realization for you that you once you surrendered maybe Lewis's perspective, you got another one more satisfying. But
yeah, I listened to some more Bill Craig, and that I'm going, oh, okay, lights are coming on a little bit there. So yeah, and he is a brilliant man. Like he's. Yeah.
Did you ever listen to the tape, the talk that he did on time called God, Time, and Eternity? We have it at Stand to Reason.
I haven't got to that one yet.
Oh, well, you may want to just take advantage of that. It's an elegant argument. I like listening to it partly because it's so nicely reasoned, but it gives his whole case there about the issue of God and time.
He is, and when he's talking to people, too, about stuff, like, he is such an ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
The man's got some good graces, like, you know, like yourself, he's a good example.
Thank you. Could you lean a little bit more into the phone, Craig? I think we're having a little hard time hearing you. That's all right.
Sorry.
Okay.
So, to the question.
To the question.
As this, and I'm hoping I'm not going to fumble on this one like I did over the time thing with Lewis. Now, I was trying to explain to some people about the nature of God in respect to the Trinity and the difference between one what and three who's, and the difference between the essence of persons. And one of the ways I said was that, well, we think about ourselves as human beings, we have a certain being that is human, and we share in that being certain characteristics. We're mortal, and we're limited in our knowledge and such and such.
Right.
And I said, but yet we are individual persons all sharing the same being. I says, it might be something like that.
Okay.
God has a being, and that being is omnipotent, omnipresent, like holy, all the stuff that we know about him, and as well as part of that being a unity, which is why the Son cannot go against the Father, because it's part of the nature of God.
Yeah, let me respond to that. I think you're onto something useful, but I'd want to make some clarifications, and you know, some of my more theologically astute friends, if they're listening in, they may want to correct me on this. We had Fred Sanders on a couple of weeks ago. He'd be the guy to ask this question. But here's what I think I want to say. I think I want to say that in the case, yes, God has an essence, and yes, there is a human essence. But in the case of human beings, we share the same kind of essence. We don't share the same essence. We each have individuated examples of the same essence.
Okay.
So you and I share in common human nature or human essence. I'm just going to use those terms synonymously for this, for the sake of our discussion. We have we are essentially human, and we could never be anything else, because that being our essence, if in fact something that essence were changed, then we literally would not be the same. We would cease to exist, and something else entirely would come into existence. That's why humans can't change into animals, because they have different essences. The human would cease to exist, the animal would come into existence, and there'd be no sense in which one became the other. So we share a human essence, but they're individuated. You have your instance of human essence, I have mine.
So even when we talk in terms of humankind or mankind, when we say it in that sense, are we not talking about the essence or being of human?
Yes. So we share the same kind of essence, but we are not the same individual essence. We are not sharing the same individual. There is no universal mind. That's kind of Jungian, maybe. I don't know. It's not like there's a universal mind, in that we are kind of all little examples of it, or individuated characterizations of that universal mind.
Yeah, that's not the way that I'm understanding it, as a universal mind or universal consciousness, or however that's characterized. I'm still trying to identify or like break it down, that we each have our individual personalities, our individual spirits or souls.
Right.
Right. that separate us and make a difference from each other. And one of the ways that I was thinking about this, and I'll just read the question I had written down, was, why does Jesus, as fully God, need to know the date and time for the second coming?
Right.
If the Father, Son, and Spirit share all knowledge,
right,
what would have their community and diversity in the Trinity been like for the eternity before creation?
There wouldn't have been that kind of problem prior to that, because that was before the humbling that Jesus experienced is described in Philippians 2, or I should say the word experience to become Jesus the man, or to add humanity to his divinity. I'm not sure if that issue will be resolved by resolving this particular question. I think what I'm going to, and I'll kind of make this a summary statement because we've got to move on.
Sure.
To a break, but I guess what I'm going to want to insist on here is that I think you're on to something when you say that human beings share the same kind of essence. But if we said we share the same essence, that would be inaccurate, because we are separate, completely individuated beings. In the case of Jesus and the Spirit and the Father, they also share the same kind of essence, but that essence is not individuated in the same way that human essences are. They are actually sharing one essence, the one singular essence of God, and there is no other creature that has that essence.
So that doesn't pose a problem. Then we talk about our nature being fallen, like that we have this part of original sin. If the sin nature that we have, doesn't that kind of imply that there is a shared essence in human, like with humanity, that has brought us to the state that we are?
Well, the way I'd put it is this way: let's just say both your parents have brown eyes, and that you are the offspring of your parents, and because of the way genetics works, you have brown eyes too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, your brown eyes are your own brown eyes,
mm-hmm.
but they are a result of parents who, in making their contribution to you as a new individuated individual, pass something on to you that is now your own and not theirs. It is in virtue of them that you have. It's in virtue of their brown eyes that you have brown eyes, but you don't have their brown eyes. You have your own. And by the same token, when the human nature is reproduced in the act of procreation by mom and dad, what is reproduced is the only thing they can pass on. That is a fallen human nature.
Right.
And so every human being is, even though they're individuated, they carry the marks of the fallen nature that produced their individual nature that is of like kind as their nature.
Okay.
So there you go.
I think I'm tracking what you're saying.
All right, Greg.
I'm walking away from this one better than I did the last one.
Sounds good, Greg. I appreciate your fine question.
Thanks a lot.
Good talking to you in Calgary. Greg is a regular on our Twitter, in our Twitter community every show. So we appreciate that, Greg. And if you'd like to do that too, go to STR Tweets or go to twitter.com. And type in STR Tweets, and you can be part of that conversation. Time to go to a break, right? We're a little over. I'm Greg Kokel. I'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, and boy, am I excited to offer you my new book, Tactics. It's a book that I wrote to help you discuss your Christian convictions with non-Christians. And it outlines specific steps to follow that you can take that will help those conversations be less intimidating and more effective. And we've seen a tremendous response to this book, and many people have already told me how much it will help them. And I hope it will help you too. To get a copy for yourself or as a gift, simply visit tacticsbook.com. It's my aim to help you make a difference for the kingdom with this book. To order your copy, simply visit tacticsbook.com.
Are you tired of searching for reliable information on current issues of interest to Christians? Like why Jesus is the only way? Same-sex marriage, evolution, and atheism, and then wading through pages of entries without finding what you were looking for? Well, I think I can help you with that today. Next time you start to Google that topic that has you searching, why not give str.org a chance first? At str.org, you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the many issues that challenge the Christian thinker in today's world. Take a few moments to browse str.org to find topics ranging from ethical issues like embryonic stem cell research to the theological debate about faith and works, and everything in between. I'm convinced you'll come away from SDR.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. It is also the place to learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth of your convictions. And while you're there, don't leave without signing up to receive our free monthly resources, Solid Ground and Greg's Personal Mentoring Letter. Both of these are written to encourage you and help you to grow more effective as an ambassador. They are free, and by signing up, you'll have complete access to all content on SDR.org. I'm convinced that your visit to SDR.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's SDR.org.
Basic training for your mind. That's what you get here at Stand to Reason. We've got about 10 more minutes in our hour, and next hour, James White will be my guest. His book, The King James Only Controversy, Can You Trust Modern Translations? By the way, important for all of us for a number of reasons, as you'll see, whether or not we are personally embroiled in that particular controversy. As I understand from what he said, the ranks of those who are willing to fight this battle are diminishing, and I am glad for that. And but the reasons why, I think, will become evident when we talk with James White. So I hope you stay with us for the final hour when we're going to talk about his latest edition of the King James Only Controversy. Let's go to Fullerton, California. Glad to have you on, Ken.
Hey, how are you doing, Greg?
Okay, or do you prefer Kenneth?
Kenneth I do prefer, actually.
Okay. All right, Kenneth, so be it.
All right, so I don't know if you remember me from a couple weeks ago when you were guest hosting or sitting in for Talk from the Heart.
Yeah, right, Rich Buehler. Well, it doesn't come to mind. Well, let's just deal with your issue right now, and it'll save a little time. We'll just jump into it. Maybe I'll recall our prior conversation.
Well, just regarding the dichotomy of Israel and the church. So from where I remember we left off, we did come to some agreement that that Israel, or that the church is grafted into Israel. Is that how I understood your conclusion?
Well, here's the way I would put it. The covenants are grounded in God's relationship with Israel.
Okay.
The Abrahamic covenant, the Mosaic covenant, the Davidic covenant, the Palestinian covenant, the New Covenant are all grounded in there. That's where they emerge from. However, some of those covenants were not intended by God long-term to be just for Israel. And in fact, the Mosaic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant clearly is not, because the purpose clause of the Abrahamic covenant, Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, the third verse says the purpose clause is that Israel would be a blessing to all the nations. And I think the final expression of that is the new covenant, which is originally established with Israel in Jeremiah 31. But what Paul describes is that, now, and you use the word church, I'm going to use the word Paul uses just so there's clarity here. He says the Gentiles are grafted in. So Gentiles are made participants in a covenant that was originally a Jewish covenant. It is native to them, in a sense, and foreign to Gentiles, but Gentiles were always the object of even this new covenant. This is part of God's plan from the beginning, and that's why I went back to Genesis 12, verse 3. So when the Gentiles are grafted in to the covenant with Israel, the covenant they are grafted into is the new covenant.
Right.
It isn't the Abrahamic, it isn't the Davidic, it isn't the Palestinian, it isn't the Mosaic. It is the new covenant. And in the new covenant, the dividing walls between the Jews and the Gentiles have been broken down. The dividing wall was the law. It kept the groups distinct, and now they're new man. Ephesians chapter 2. This one new man in the New Testament is called the church. I take this organism, the church, the called out ones, if you will, the ecclesia, to be a unique development of the New Covenant period. I do not think the church is part of the Old Testament, that was the Jews. In the New Testament, we have the flowering of the New Covenant, which creates a new creature, as Paul says, one new man.
And in this new man, there under the new covenant provisions, then there are no distinctions between Jew and Gentile, slave and free, male and female. Notice, by the way, in the New Testament, are there actually distinctions made between male and female?
In the Scripture, I believe so.
Yeah, I agree with you. So here Paul must be talking about, in a limited sense, in a particular and peculiar sense, there is no distinction between male and female. That is underneath the provisions of the New Covenant. By the same token, even though under the provisions of the New Covenant, there are no distinctions between Jew and Greek, we are one man in Christ, as it were, there still can be other legitimate distinctions based on other covenants between Israel, the Jews, and the Gentiles. And that's why I'm dispensational, because I can hold that distinction. I think that distinction is biblically legitimate. So,
I'm sorry, can you repeat that distinction?
Okay. Well, I was just asserting that there was a distinction, or actually arguing that there was a distinction. There could be a distinction between the church or Gentiles and Jews with regards to other covenants. Just like there are distinctions between male and female with regards to other things, yet under the new covenant, under those provisions, there is no distinction. So I make a distinction then between Israel as a nation and the church as a new organism, which contains both Jews and Gentiles under the new covenant. I think there are promises made regarding Israel as a nation that are still unique to the nation of Israel. And because I make a distinction between Israel and the church, this is the hinge pin distinction between those who are dispensational in their theology and those who are covenant in their theology.
Okay. I guess to clarify, if I said, if I said that the church was grafted into Israel, I didn't misspeak. I did mean Gentiles. But
okay.
to kind of go on from there, I hope maybe I can call again in the future, because I have a lot of thoughts on this issue. I don't think we're going to resolve this in the next few minutes.
No, I don't think so either. It's a long-standing debate.
Yeah.
Does that help what I've said so far?
Yeah, well, so I do have a follow-up question.
Okay.
At this point.
All right.
And my question is, were Gentiles permitted to enter into the assembly of ancient Israel?
Yeah, the answer to that is yes, and there are a number of examples of it. One of them is Rahab. I mean, obvious examples, Rahab, and she's on the genealogy of Jesus.
Right.
There are a bunch of others as well, but there was provision for Gentiles. Look, there were provisions for Gentiles to stay Gentiles but still worship the Jewish God at the Jewish temple. That was called the Court of the Gentiles. There was also provisions for Gentiles to actually be adopted into the community of Israel. And Rahab is an example of that.
Yeah, males had to be circumcised and so on.
Yes, that's right.
So I'm just curious, in Ephesians, I'm driving again, so in Ephesians when it mentions that when Paul is writing that, I think you alluded to the concept a little bit, that that they were brought near to the commonwealth of Israel, could you elaborate on what you mean by that?
You must be referring to chapter 2, and he tells the Gentiles that that they were dead in their transgressions and sins. They walked in darkness. They were without God and without hope in the world. And then they were transplanted in virtue of the new covenant, into a covenant that originated with the Jews. And he says in verse 13, "Now in Christ Jesus, you who were formerly far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ." And he abolished the enmity, the law and commandments contained in ordinances, this Mosaic covenant, that was a wall, a cultural wall, I'm paraphrasing here now, a cultural wall between the Jews and the Gentiles, and then he made the two into one body through the cross, having put to death the enmity, which is the law. And through him, we both have our access, both Jews and Gentiles, in one spirit, to the Father. And so then you were no longer strangers, aliens, but fellow citizens, and
I'm finishing up here in chapter 2 of Ephesians, and then identifies that the household of God that they are now citizens in was built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets. Jesus was the cornerstone. It's a holy temple to the Lord, and you're all being built together into dwelling of God in the Spirit. Now you guys, the people, are the temple of the Holy Spirit. So I think that very clearly identifies the nature of the new covenant, which is meant to bring all the Jews and the Gentiles together under one economy. And that is the new and better economy, which cannot be broken like the Mosaic covenant was broken.
Okay. So, as far as the finer point, though, of when he says that being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world, and then he says, like, you're through Christ, you're brought near. Why the emphasis on commonwealth of Israel?
Because the commonwealth of Israel was the means by which God meant to secure the salvation of the rest of the world.
Okay.
And God, here's the plan. I'll give it to you quickly. We're almost out of time.
Sure.
God chose, I mean, you've got Genesis and the fall, and then you've got this dispersion of the nations, the Tower of Babel.
Yeah.
Then what? God calls a man. In the midst of this chaos, he calls a man Abram. He promises to make a great nation out of him. And then he chooses then to take that nation and gives him. He's going to give him what nations require: a government, a land, and a people. And then he is sovereignly choosing to take that nation and use that nation to be a blessing to the fallen world. And the details of that are worked out over the next up through Malachi, you know. But that's the first statement of it. So the commonwealth, that is the nation of Israel itself, was built and established sovereignly by God for a very particular and peculiar purpose. That's what it means that God chose Israel, because he was going to use them to communicate his word to them, and through them he was going to work with them so other nations could see the mighty hand of God being worked out through the nation of Israel, and ultimately the new covenant and the Messiah and the blessing of the nations would come through them. So they are central to the process. Good question, Kenneth. Appreciate talking with you, and I'll look forward to our next conversation. All right, in 2 minutes, Dr. James White will be my guest. We'll be talking about the King James only controversy. You do not want to miss this. Stay tuned for more on Stand to Reason.
I would like to ask you a very important question.
All right, friends, our final hour here on Stand to Reason. And I think it's going to be a very interesting one for you, especially very informative. There has been a tremendous amount of controversy of late about the history and the background and reliability of the biblical text, both from the inside and from the outside of the church. And we have devoted some shows to this issue because it's so important. And on the one extreme in the church, you have pastors arguing refined points of theology from the pulpit using free translations like The Message and others like it. On the other hand, on the other extreme, there are those who view their own preferred translation as the one and only inspired translation. This would be characteristically the King James only crowd. That's inside the church. Outside the church, you have people like Bart Ehrman tearing into the Bible all over the place. I don't know how many books he's got out now. He's got 3 or 4 of them. And they're all doing well. And of course, his main point is, no one can know what the originals said. It's lost forever, so for all intents and purposes, we have no authoritative scripture. And when I have questions on these issues, friends, I frequently turn to the work of my guest today. He's the director of Alpha Omega Ministries. He is the author of more than 20 books, including the one which is our topic today. And in fact, this is a newer release
So I have two copies of it now, the older one and the new one. It's called The King James Only Controversy. Can you trust modern translations? His name is James White, and actually he might be called the King James of the King James Only Controversy. James, welcome to the show.
Well, let's hope not. I'd never heard of that one before, but we'll keep that one on the back burner.
Well, I'm really glad you're able to join us today, and I think that the last time we actually talked was when I gave you a phone call to get some private tutoring on a refined point of textual criticism or a textual variant or something earlier this year. Do you remember that?
Yeah, is that this year? I start losing track after a while.
But it's nice to be able to have someone to go to that has a lot more information on it than I do. And the rank and file can't call you, but certainly they can make use of their book, your book, The King James Only Controversy. And I've gone there a lot to try to make sense out of this this situation. By the way, I know that you've done stuff not just with this issue, James, but also with Bart Ehrman. I thought I heard somebody tell me that they heard that you allegedly listened to every single debate Bart Ehrman ever did and read every one of his books. Is that true or is that apocryphal?
I have all of his books. Some of his books were not relevant to the debate we did, but I do believe that I listened to everything that he has done that is relevant to that subject, which is actually a limited amount. I mean, he would give pretty much the same presentation. And in fact, if you listen to the presentations he makes, the debates he's done, he debated Dan Wallace about a year before I did, actually about 9 months before I did, and he pretty much makes the same presentation all the way around. Mm-hmm. So being prepared for him wasn't overly difficult. But yeah, I even had a lady back east reading a number of his articles into MP3 for me before I was able to.
Oh, is that right?
Obtain the software that I use now, where anything in PDF, doc, anything like that, I can turn into very well-read MP3s to listen to. That's
no kidding. I'm going to have to email you and get the info on that because that you can convert everything to podcasts. I don't know about you. I spent a lot of time on the freeway living in Los Angeles, so that'll make my time a lot more productive.
No, I spend my time on the back of a bicycle, and that's when I do my studying.
Oh, that's right. I remember you told me once that you were listening to a conversation here, an interview, while you're right, okay, and something that was said almost caused you to have a wreck. But
that's right.
we won't go there. That was a different issue. You write that most Christians. I want to think of getting an introduction or laying a foundation here to the work that you've done in the King James Only controversy. And you write there that most Christians are a little bit fuzzy on how we got the Bible in the first place. So I think that maybe it would be helpful for people who are unfamiliar with these issues to have a little, maybe a tutorial in textual criticism, and I don't mean in the refined art of choosing one variant over another, but rather, how the field lays out, and autographs versus copies, manuscript variations, manuscript traditions, and the kind of thing that sets the stage for this debate that is a real important one, the King James Only controversy.
Wow, that's a summary of a very, very large area. And it is true. I think one of the primary reasons that we have this issue is because the church is afraid to talk about it and doesn't do education in it, because even our seminaries don't do much of it. I mean, if I hadn't pushed myself when I was in seminary for more information on this, hadn't taken 7 years of Greek and things like that, I could have easily graduated with a very surface-level knowledge of the background of the Bible, how we got it, the manuscripts, the differences in manuscripts. And I think that's where Ehrman really has his niche, in essence, is he recognizes this fact and he plays upon this fact. Almost everything he says, those of us who paid attention in seminary have known about all along. And he admits that in his books, if you actually read them. He admits that what he's saying isn't overly new. It's just that vast majority of people don't know, for example, that John chapter 5, for example, you can find an entire verse in verse 4 of John chapter 5 that comes from many hundreds of years after the time of the writing of the New Testament. And people are not aware of that, and so when you point it out, you can use it as a general argument for general unreliability rather than a recognition that there are really only two three variants that are about that long as far as the number of words and stuff are considered in that context. Mm-hmm. So all you got to do is just make sure that people don't know that, and you can make up for it along those lines. Mm-hmm. So what we need to do is educate our people, let them know that the Bible didn't just drop down out of heaven, in a leather binding with some mm-hmm. some index, and we can undo a lot of the damage that folks like Bart Ehrman can do if we just do the education in the proper context.
I've said that Bart Ehrman seems to be correct on almost all of his facts and wrong on almost all of his conclusions.
Yeah.
In other words, what he does with the facts, as you mentioned, most of the things that he cites in his books regarding the problem with the variations is not new to those of us who kind of follow these issues. In fact, I thought that issue was long dead, because it had been resolved in our favor, and then he goes and writes this popular work that brings it resurrects all of these old issues that have been resolved along time ago, it seems to me. Why would there be a problem of this kind at all? Talk a little bit about manuscript transmission, and about what amount to families of manuscripts, because the family of manuscript concepts does play importantly into the whole question of the King James only controversy.
Right. Well, the period of time during which the New Testament is transmitted, where you have the widest explosion of manuscripts, the uncontrolled reproduction of manuscripts, is basically in the first 300 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a period of time of great upheaval. The church is under persecution until 313 AD. Even to copy and own the scriptures can cost you your life in many areas of the Roman Empire. And so yet the Christians wanted to get the word out. And so there is just this large amount of copying and transmitting the text. There had to be, because the Romans were destroying manuscripts and mm-hmm. And things like that. And so you obviously, when you have handwritten manuscripts, you make mistakes in handwriting and in copying somebody else's work. Even today, mm-hmm. as we sit in our nice air-conditioned offices with good lighting and working on a MacBook Pro with underlines, every misspelled
spell checkers,
and grammar checkers and everything else, and LASIK surgery and all the rest of that stuff. We still obviously make mistakes, and we're copying from one work to another.
Mm-hmm.
And if that happens with us, certainly it happened with individuals who were working with much less technology, with a pen and a piece of papyri, mm-hmm. Swatting the mosquitoes that were bothering them as well. And so the reality is the number of variations, given the fact that we have about 5,760 cataloged manuscripts of the New Testament, that's part or in whole of the New Testament. Most of the early ones are partial. Most of the later ones are more whole copies. Mm-hmm. Given that represents about 1,500 years of handwritten transmission of the text, the number of variations we have is extremely small.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there were variations that would come in. People would misspell a word. They would reverse the order of words, especially when you had passages that are found in Matthew and Mark or Mark and Luke. And the person copying it was more accustomed to how Matthew had it.
Mm-hmm.
It was very common for them to make changes in Mark so that it sounded like Matthew, either mm-hmm. purposely or just simply because that's how they had it memorized, for mm-hmm. example, parallel text and things like that. Very common for the eye to skip from one line to the other, from one word that ends in a common grammatical termination to another word and skip the intervening words, and just common things that we do to this day, and we have mm-hmm. to do proofreading to catch. And you can see in manuscripts where people caught by a proofreading various mm-hmm. things like this, but sometimes you still miss it no matter how hard you try.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are scribal errors. Now, if we only had 6 or 7 manuscripts of any one book, that would be a bit of a problem mm-hmm. because you'd have a hard time coming up with what the original was. But the New Testament is by far the most widely and most ancient attested work of antiquity. There is no work that comes close to it as mm-hmm. far as the manuscript tradition is concerned. And so you compare these manuscripts with one another, knowing the common errors the scribes make. And you also look at the manuscripts themselves and say, well, I have a manuscript here from, say, the 12th century, and it's very nicely done. But here I have a manuscript from the 4th century, and it's not nearly nicely done. However, given the fact that it's 800 years closer
to the original,
it has a greater probability of representing the original than one that's written 800 years later. Now, there are some few exceptions to that. We know of some 10th, 11th century manuscripts that we can tell were being copied directly from a very, very, very ancient manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, that's not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
In general, you would have a situation where the older the manuscript is, the more weight it's going to carry.
Well, see, this is actually part, I think, among those who do textual criticism, you know, part of the controversy, as I understand it, that you have fewer documents early on, obviously because of their antiquity, and because of the fact that there was persecution in the Western Church, and so a lot of these things just disappeared. So there's not that much to go from. Then you have older documents. I should say that you have more recent documents that a greater majority of those recent documents, but they have different readings. So you kind of this odd situation where the fewer documents that are earlier have one reading, but the majority of documents that are later have a different reading. And so there's a little competition about whether you go with the earliest reading or you go with the majority reading.
Yeah, and basically what you're dealing with there is what is traditionally known as the Alexandrian text type being the earliest text that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is geographical in its reasoning. That is, papyri manuscripts, which were the first writing materials that were used by the Christians, generally don't do well in wet areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so the general type of text you get from Egypt and the sands of Egypt is the Alexandrian text type. And then you have a later text type, which is a little bit fuller. What I mean by fuller is its readings tend to be a little bit longer. There's conflations of earlier readings and things like that. Is called the Byzantine text type. And these are the two major text types. There's also a Western, and some people have identified a Caesarean and things like that. But it's these two major ones that most of the argumentation takes place.
Mm-hmm.
Between the two. And most of the King James Only movement is a reaction against the adoption of the earlier readings.
Mm-hmm.
Because the King James is based upon the Byzantine manuscript family.
Mm-hmm.
It's really based upon about between 6 and 12 manuscripts, none of which are earlier than 1000 AD,
mm-hmm.
going back to the work of Desiderius Erasmus,
mm-hmm.
Who compiled his first Greek New Testament in 1516, and he did five editions between that and 1535, and those, along with Stephanus' work in the middle of the century and Baze's work at the end of the century, were the printed text the King James translators used between 1604 and 1611 in the translation of the King James New Testament. And the majority of the textual discussion is from the New Testament, not so much the Old Testament.
Right. I wanted to make a comment very quickly here about the idea of textual families, because you and I are both talking about these things, and it may be that there are some people out there that don't really understand this concept, the Alexandrian text type, the Byzantine text type, maybe it'd be fair to you'd give them a little characterization of this. I mean, when there are changes in texts, variations, and these variations get reflected in subsequent copies, right? And then when thousands of copies are written over time, pretty soon whole groups of copies kind of have the same kind of variation, so they look similar. Would that be a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, they're going to share the same kind of variations. A lot of it is just simply due to the fact that later on, you don't have a whole lot of movement, especially during the medieval period. I mean, most people who were born in one place in medieval Europe never traveled more than 7 miles from the place that they were born. So you're going to be copying the manuscripts that are only in your area.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a particular reading or a particular variation in one area, that tends to stay in that area.
Mm-hmm.
It's also important to recognize that historically, Greek was utilized for the first few centuries all across the Roman Empire by the Christians. But pretty early on in the western part of the empire, they started using Latin more than they did Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you have a huge upheaval in world history in the 7th century, between 632 and 732, with a fellow by the name of Muhammad and the rise of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And the spread of Islam all the way from basically the southern borders of Turkey all the way through Palestine, across North Africa and up into Spain. In the Islamic expansion, which was not really good for the production of Greek manuscripts by Christians.
Right.
and that's where a lot of the Greek was still being spoken in those areas.
Uh-huh.
So that has a huge impact on things. One of the reasons the Byzantine manuscript family is by far the majority is that from that period on, Greek manuscripts are only being produced around Byzantium,
mm-hmm.
around what's
right.
modern-day Istanbul.
Uh-huh.
And so the reason for the large majority at that point is a historical reason.
Right.
That if you're familiar with church history, you're aware of. But I want to make sure everyone understands something, because this gets lost sometimes in all the details.
Uh-huh.
If you were to take, for example, Dr. Maurice Robinson at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary is a strong proponent of the Byzantine text platform, and in mm-hmm. fact, we need to pray for Dr. Robinson. He had a heart attack this week, mm-hmm. and last I heard was in ICU. So we, mm-hmm. we hope he's doing better.
Mm-hmm.
Really fine gentleman. We don't agree on this subject, but a really fine gentleman. And if you took his text that he's produced, which is based on the Byzantine readings, and then you take the most Alexandrian Greek New Testament that's been produced, which would be the Westcott and Hort text of 1881.
Mm-hmm.
If you apply the same hermeneutical principles, practice the same exegetical principles in the interpretation of those two documents, you are not going to come up with a different faith. Now, you right. might come up with a slightly different list of verses
right.
in support of any one particular theology,
right.
but you are not going to come up with a different Christian faith. You're not going to come up with Jesus as Michael the Archangel,
right,
or
right.
no resurrection, or whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm
glad you're bringing this up here. We're going to have to go to break in just a second, James, but I'm really glad you're bringing this up, because when we start talking about some of these distinctions, it gives the impression, I think, that people like Bart Ehrman want to give, and that is that it's all up for grabs, and we can't know anything for sure about these documents because they've been tampered with, sometimes by accident, and Ehrman would say sometimes on purpose, and the Orthodox Corruption of Scripture, for example, one of his books. But we are really talking about very, very modest variations which have very little impact, if any, on the big picture theologically and the things that we consider most important. And one of the things you say in the introduction to your book, The King James Only, is that you're not against the King James Version. This is an attack on the version. All of these versions have value and they're good translations, though some might be a little better than others. There's rather a group of people, though, that have been causing problems that are saying that the King James Only translation is the only translation that any Christian should be reading. And when I come back, I'd like to just zero in on that particular issue. My guest here, James White, author of The King James Only Controversy, Can You Trust Modern Translations? We'll be back with James in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel, and you're listening to Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel here. You know, I'd like to sit down with you. That's right, right where you live or work, and cover a subject in depth that I think is worthy of your attention. Sound like something you'd like to do? Well, the good news is that every other month we can do just that when you sign up to receive the latest edition of SDR's newsletter called Solid Ground. In each issue, I write about a timely issue facing Christians in the real world today. And my desire is that each issue of Solid Ground gives you the practical knowledge you need to represent your faith as an ambassador for Christ in an effective and an attractive manner. Now, some of the subjects we've covered recently have been the new atheists, a proper understanding of faith, the historical Jesus, taking verses out of context, things like that. So let's spend that time together. And I think you might just find yourself a little more comfortable when a heated or sensitive topic comes up in your family or at your workplace or maybe at your church. Call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, or visit str.org and click on the Solid Ground link on the left-hand side of our homepage and start getting Solid Ground delivered right to your door. It's free, by the way, so what's stopping you and I from having our discussion?
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Greg Kokel here with you on Stand to Reason. My guest, James White, the author of a number of books, 20 different books. Well, you must be tired, James.
Actually, I haven't written in about 3 years. I'm going to be talking with Bethany House next week about ending that drought. I've been doing too many debates.
Oh, okay. Well, you've done over 100 debates, according to the information that Melinda gathered, and I'm glad you're doing the heavy lifting for the rest of us, because we can take advantage of listening to your debates and read your books, because the scholarship is really great here. Dealing in this particular case with the King James Only controversy, in order to understand that controversy, we have to understand some things about just the background history. We've been covering that in our first segment so far. By the way, James, I was in the UK with my wife in July. We had like 10 days by ourselves without the kids, and it was really nice. But the only time we spent really in London proper, it's the first day we got there, and I headed right over to the British Museum, and I wanted to see the display of Sinaiticus and Alexandrinus kind of sitting right side by side to each other, which was pretty thrilling for me, since those are two of the three most important codices of the early part of the first millennium. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I got to see the same thing before they pulled it for a while for the digitalization project for Sinaiticus. I wish they'd do Alexandrinus as well, but there's probably not that kind of money for it. I was surprised at how much smaller Alexandrinus was than Sinaiticus, but it is amazing the access we have today. Sinaiticus is available fully online now. I'm sitting here with my Accordance Bible software up in front of me, and I can click on one tab, and I have the Nesyalin text, the commentary, Metzger, Comfort, the CNTTS apparatus. I can click on the next one. There's Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, Washingtonius, Beze, the papyri. All sitting there in front of me, and it's fully searchable. It's just amazing the amount of information.
I'll let you do all the searching and the writing. We'll read what you come up with in books like the King James Only controversy. There is a history here of translation that I think is important, and it's a fascinating introduction to that history that you start out with as you talk about the Septuagint, and then Jerome, who does the translation into the Vulgate, and some of the controversy that created, and then later Erasmus, who then takes the Vulgate and does a parallel with the Greek there, and the conflict that created, all setting up for the King James translation that comes from Erasmus's work in the Greek. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Well, it is fascinating that there are people today who do not learn the lessons of history, and they take a translation that they have become accustomed to, and that they become accustomed to hearing God speaking through, and ignore the fact that the human tendency is to take that and exalt it to a position it was never meant to have.
In other words, your traditional text, in other words, becomes the one inspired thing.
Exactly, and any variation from that causes you no end of difficulties. This has happened many times. It happened historically when Jerome translated the Latin Vulgate. The Bible of the early church was the Greek Septuagint. And people rarely recognize or understand that, but the Bible that the early Christians referred to, that was quoted all the time in the New Testament, the vast majority of citations of the Old Testament do not come from the Hebrew Old Testament. They come from the Greek Septuagint. And for hundreds of years, that had been used so much that there were many early Christians that believed that the Greek Septuagint itself was the standard, mm-hmm. and any variation from the Septuagint was bad.
Yes, if it's good enough for the Apostle Paul, it's good enough for us, I guess,
well, exactly.
was the mentality. I mean, precisely in that situation, that's what Paul used.
Yeah, exactly. And so what you end up having happen is the reality that once Jerome translates the Latin Vulgate, and the first time it is read in public, there's a near riot in Carthage because he changes some of the terminology that is used at that particular point in time.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing is then happens to Erasmus when Erasmus wants to go back to the original languages, and he makes some changes in the Latin and provides the Greek. He is attacked vociferously because, for at that point, 1,100 years,
mm-hmm.
the Latin had been the standard,
mm-hmm.
and as a result, people attack him because he's attacking the translations mm-hmm. been used by God's people, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that repeats over and over again. I hope there's not an NIV-only movement coming someday. Or, Crossway, I think, maybe starting an ESV-only movement mm-hmm. or something like that. I don't mm-hmm. know.
But history repeats itself because people get attached to certain translations that are the norm for their community, and then they start to attach this, in a sense, divine significance to the translation. And you mentioned that Jerome dealt with that, and then later on, then Erasmus. Now, Erasmus has done something unique in providing a Greek New Testament, and that had not been done before, but that becomes the underlying foundational Greek manuscripts that the King James translation, the received text, if you will, comes from. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, Erasmus produces five editions between 1516 and 1535. He is rushing to get his out the amazing thing is, really, honestly, it's another example of dealing with
local politics.
Marketing is what it is.
Okay.
It's dealing with marketing. And what happens is his printer is putting pressure upon him to get this done as quickly as possible. And that's because his printer already knows that someone else has produced a Greek New Testament. In fact, it's a multi-volume classical piece, and it was already printed.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was it was sitting in a warehouse, and back in those days when you published something, you had to get papal approval for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that was a very long process. It wasn't like you could fax anything in.
Right.
And so Cardinal Jimenez had already finished his work. The printer knew that, so he was putting a lot of pressure on Erasmus. What they did is they ended up skipping papal approval by dedicating the book to the Pope,
uh-huh.
hoping that would be enough to get around the red tape.
So he's trying to scoop the other guy and beat the red tape by saying, well, I'm going to dedicate to this to you, Pope, so it's going to be difficult for the Pope now to object to the printing. Did we just lose? I think we just lost James. We're working on it now. We're working on Skype here, so we just got disconnected. But let me just repeat the point there. There is, Erasmus wants to get this new Greek translation of the New Testament out in people's hands. The trend there was to go back to the original documents, and he's making it available to them. But you got to get the Pope's approval. Somebody else is doing the same thing, so there's a race to the deadline. Who's going to scoop who? And as it turns out, Erasmus jumps the gun, dedicates the book to the Pope, and in the process is able to get this translation, this Greek translation of the New Testament, out and available to people to begin perusing for themselves. We got James back on?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we have a King James only operator somewhere on the
Well, I just recouped the story that you just told. So now we've got this this hurried translation of the Greek out by Erasmus, and this really creates a stir that anybody is getting back to the Greek now.
Well, there was a story even before that. The Renaissance call for ad fontes to the source,
right,
was troubling to a lot of conservative Roman Catholics for obvious reasons, for many, many reasons. And I did want to tell at least one story about what happened because Erasmus rushed it. He got to the Book of Revelation, and a lot of people are not aware of this, and I hope Tim LaHaye is not listening, but
I don't think he is.
Okay. The New Testament book that we have the fewest manuscripts of is the Book of Revelation. And there's a lot of reasons for that historically. I mean, it did have to fight for inclusion in the canon, and I'm glad that it did, in the sense that I'm glad the early Christians just weren't, you know, ransacking their local libraries for every book that talked about 12-headed monsters and things like that. I'm glad that there was a examination and so on and so forth. But we have the fewest manuscripts of it, and it's the least copied. We only have about 400. And so when Erasmus moved to Basel, Switzerland, to continue his work on that project, he thought he'd find lots of material there. He couldn't find a single manuscript of the Book of Revelation. He had to borrow a commentary on Revelation by his friend Johannes Reuchlin, who, by the way, was the first person to write a Hebrew grammar for Christians.
He risked
his life to learn Hebrew back in those days. And he had to extract the text of Revelation from a commentary, from a single commentary, to produce his text for the Book of Revelation. Well, he had another problem. He got to the last chapter, and the last pages of the book had fallen off, which happened a lot back then.
It happens to some of my books, too.
Yeah, and so what he did is he translated from the Latin Vulgate into Greek to produce the last six verses of Revelation chapter 22.
So he back-translates from the version.
He back-translates from the Latin into Greek, exactly. And in the process creates a number of readings that no one had ever seen before, and yet, to this day, not only does the King James continue to have those readings in Revelation chapter 22, but if you were to purchase a Textus Receptus from, say, the Trinitarian Bible Society and look at the last six verses of Revelation 22, they all continue to have the readings that Erasmus inserted when he first rushed it in 1516.
Well, this is a good opportunity now to transition into the King James Version. You mentioned the Textus Receptus. I think people who have studied this a bit have heard this phrase. Tell us what that is and the relationship to the King James Version and how the King James Bible came about.
The Textus Receptus is a Latin phrase that was developed in 1633 by the Elsevier brothers when they were advertising an edition of the Greek New Testament that they had produced. It's actually an advertising blurb. Believe it or not, people advertised in Latin in the 1700s. It tells you a little bit about how things have changed. And it simply means the received text or the common text. It is a compilation of the five editions of Erasmus, the 1550 edition of Stephanus, which, by the way, just to make you jealous, I had an actual 1550 Stephanus text donated to me a couple months ago.
No kidding. Goodness gracious.
I have an actual 1550 Stephanus. It's in awesome shape. And the 1598 Beza translation, Calvin's successor, Geneva. The King James translators between 1604 and 1611 had all seven of those editions available to them, and they had to make choices because they don't read identical to one another. They're close, but they don't read identically to one another. What then happened was the Textus Receptus that you can buy today, normally in a blue case-bound version from Trinitarian Bible Society, Scrivener went back in the 1800s, and he took those printed editions. The King James translators did not go to manuscripts. They went to the printed editions and producing their translation. And he determined where they had made choices between these different printed texts, and he created a standardized text based upon the King James English translation. So the modern TR is actually an English-based Greek text. Where the choices, the textual choices, have been determined by looking at what the King James translators decided.
Okay, now I have a question. I'm a little confused in this. So it was my impression that the Textus Receptus is the handful of texts that form the basis for the King James translation itself, and that the Textus Receptus is very similar to but not identical with the Byzantine text or the majority text.
They're actually there are actually about 1,800 differences between the Texas Receptus and the majority text.
Okay, so, but it reflects more of the majority text than, say, the more ancient Alexander. Okay, but now it sounds like you're saying that the Textus Receptus is actually something that was constructed, or at least portions of it, after the fact, after the King James Bible was translated, and then it was constructed from the King James translation? To clarify
right.
that
there,
point.
There is, the Textus Receptus refers to really a family of texts, and in general, it's the text you would come up with by comparing those published translations that existed prior to the King James, but there are a number of different variations and differences between them. And the Textus Receptus that is used in King James-only Bible colleges and things like that, the actual Greek text that is printed today called the Textus Receptus is actually the work of Scrivener based upon his analysis of the textual choices the King James translated.
Okay. So in other words, the King James translators are making textually critical decisions from the differences based on this handful of manuscripts, 10 or 12 manuscripts that they have in their possession. And when those, all of those decisions are obviously represented and recorded in the King James Version, and once that's done, then it's back, the King James Version is back translated into Greek to show then you have...
No, actually, see, what happened is the King James translators did not use manuscripts. They only used printed editions. They used the five editions of Erasmus, the one of Stephanos, and the one
other
of
English, other English editions. Is that what you meant?
No, those aren't English editions. Those are all Greek New Testaments,
okay.
The five of Erasmus, the one of Stephanos, the one of Beza. These are all editions of the Greek New Testament.
Oh, I got
those
you.
Those are the seven that the King James translators drew from, but they don't always agree.
Yeah.
So they had to make choices.
Okay, so the difference here is that they're not working with raw ancient manuscripts. They are working with someone else's printed collection of those manuscripts. Okay, I got it now. So and then this then becomes the underlying Greek for the underlying manuscript, if you will, these printed editions for the King James Version, the English Bible. Okay,
right. So and I think people need to understand there is no single manuscript in the world that reads identical to what you have in the King James Version of the Bible. So every time that people are saying, well, you know, I don't like them making changes, blah, blah, blah. Well, the reality is Erasmus had to make choices in the manuscripts that he had.
Right.
Beza did the same thing. Stephanos did the same thing. Everyone is reading a text that has had someone engaged in textual critical study of it one way or the other.
Okay.
You can either be ignorant of who they were, or you can know who they were.
Okay, good. Well, when we come back for break, we're going to get into the specifics of the King James controversy itself proper, now that we have the foundation laid, and what are the different kinds of King James-only advocates, and what their claims are, and what's wrong with their claims. I'm talking with James White. He's the author of The King James-Only Controversy, Can You Trust Modern Translations? The show is Stand to Reason. Stay with us till next break.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, and boy, am I excited to offer you my new book, Tactics. It's a book that I wrote to help you discuss your Christian convictions with non-Christians. And it outlines specific steps to follow that you can take that will help those conversations be less intimidating and more effective. Now, we've seen a tremendous response to this book, and many people have already told me how much it will help them. And I hope it will help you, too. To get a copy for yourself or as a gift, simply visit tacticsbook.com. It's my aim to help you make a difference for the kingdom with this book. To order your copy, simply visit tacticsbook.com.
Are you tired of searching for reliable information on current issues of interest to Christians? Like why Jesus is the only way, same-sex marriage, evolution, and atheism? And then wading through pages of entries without finding what you were looking for? Well, I think I can help you with that today. Next time you start to Google that topic that has you searching, why not give str.org a chance first? At str.org, you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the many issues that challenge the Christian thinker in today's world. Take a few moments to browse str.org to find topics ranging from ethical issues like embryonic stem cell research to the theological debate about faith and works, and everything in between. I'm convinced you'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. It is also the place to learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth of your convictions. And while you're there, don't leave without signing up to receive our free monthly resources, Solid Ground and Greg's Personal Mentoring Letter. Both of these are written to encourage you and help you to grow more effective as an ambassador. They are free, and by signing up, you'll have complete access to all content on str.org. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.
Greg Kokel with you here on Stand to Reason. My guest, James White, the book, The King James Only Controversy. We've covered a lot of history so far, James. It brings us to the point of talking specifically about this controversy. And in your book, you describe four different groups that are kind of players that in some way or another are King James Only groups. Identify those for us and tell us the ones that are really the most important to talk about.
Well, obviously what you have is a spectrum when it comes to the King James Only movement. You wouldn't want to include someone like Maurice Robinson in the King James Only position, even though he's Byzantine text priority. Anybody who recognizes the King James text, as its own translators clearly said, would need editing and improvement over time. Anyone who recognizes that, I really wouldn't put in the King James Only camp at all. And yet, within those other people who are very strongly in defense of the King James, you really do sort of have to ask that kind of question, because you have your super radical people, like your Peter Ruckmans and your Gail Ripplingers, who make this the standard of all things and have just amazing claims and statements for the King James translation. Mm-hmm. And then you have others that recognize that Ruckmanism and Ripplingerism is just wacky and indefensible and strange. By the way,
Ripplinger's book was one of the most bizarre books I've ever read. It was just painful to have to go through this.
You haven't seen her recent stuff then.
Pardon me?
You haven't seen her recent stuff then.
Oh, no, not interested.
She's made that first one look like a solid tone.
Oh, my goodness. So, well, some people just like the King James Only version. They think it's elegant. They think it's beautiful. Right. And there's no problem with that, right?
No. As long as someone's not making it a test of orthodoxy or fellowship or something like that.
Right.
You know, I was raised in the King James. A lot of my memory verses still come out with these and thous. And,
right.
And my dad still prays with these and thous and everything
uh-huh.
else. That's not really the issue here
uh-huh.
at all. A preference for it, a like of it, utilization of it, no. Even a preference for the Byzantine text type, no. Even a preference for the Textus Receptus doesn't necessarily make a person King James only, because there is another major translation of the Textus Receptus, which is called the New King James Version.
Okay, so in other words, in one sense, there is a legitimate scholarly debate about the underlying Greek that was used for the King James Version, and that is even reflected in a newer translation that has tightened some things up, the New King James Version. And that's a totally legitimate debate. People can take sides on it for academic reasons. That's different than the groups of people who are saying that the King James only, the King James Bible itself is either the only inspired translation or is a brand new revelation. I never knew of that category of people.
Right.
That's a whole different kettle of fish.
Yeah, and those are the people that are the loudest. They're the ones that write the books. And it's interesting, you even have a lot of disagreement amongst those groups. Sometimes they'll be attacking one another. For example, Dr. D.A. Waite, well-known King James-only advocate, strongly disagrees with Ripplinger and Ruckman.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, here's the way to find out if you're really dealing with a King James-only person. Find out if there is any rendering anywhere in the King James Version that they admit could be better. If they say absolutely not, then you're dealing with a real King James-only mm-hmm. person. And I can't get D.A. Waite or anybody who follows him to admit that there is any verse whatsoever that could be rendered better than it is in the King James Version of the Bible.
I'm sorry.
I have to say there are a number of them, like Romans 9:5.
Titus 2:13, which, as you know, are directly relevant to the deity of Christ, where the modern translations have significantly better renderings for various reasons than the King James does. But a real King James-only advocate will actually attack those texts as being supportive of the deity of Christ so as to protect the inviolability of the King James as
right.
a translation.
Right, and this, I think, brings us a real important point on the merits of the debate here, in that you have a group of people that actually think the translation itself, word for word, and of course which King James Version translation they have, that's another question, but they hold that their translation is the English itself is the inspired version, and therefore they cannot acknowledge that there's any errors or changes that might be better, because that would be basically saying I can improve on God's word. And you do mention at some point here that a big part of the, in your book, that a big part of the debate it follows this methodology. We know, we hold, we're certain that the King James only version is word for word exactly perfect, and therefore any variation of other translations must be corrupt. Now, that strikes me as circular reasoning in a debate like this.
Well, it's not just circular reasoning. It becomes viciously circular reasoning when you join it with a whole lot of emotion and tradition and end up identifying anyone who disagrees with you as a hater of God and a hater of his word,
right.
which unfortunately is exactly what you have in the majority of the King James-only material that is put out there. But that is exactly what you have. And the one thing that identifies King James-onlyism is a inconsistency in application of standards. The standards that they will apply to the New American Standard, the NIV or the ESV or whatever else, they will never apply to the King James Version of the Bible. So it has its own set of standards. The translations that came before the King James, the translations that come after the King James, are all treated differently because fundamentally they start off with that equation. The King James Bible alone equals the Word of God alone. And therefore,
right.
if you challenge that equation, what you're actually doing is saying there is no Word of God, period. And it's hard to break through that mindset, but I'm thankful to report that the King James only controversy has made a huge dent in the King James only movement.
Well, you know, I'm glad to hear that. And you, partly because the controversy has gotten so vicious from one side, it seems, and the challenges of heresy and the like are inappropriately thrown at people who are Christians doing their best, to try to resolve some of these textual concerns. And, what would you say, if we're a little short on time here, so I'm looking for, what would you say would be the chief point that you would make to show that the King James only crowd is mistaken with regards to its convictions about the King James Version?
Well, you know, I just like to point out that to hold the King James only position, you have to say that the King James translators had no clue as to what they themselves were talking about when they wrote their own introduction, their own translation. Because if most King James Bibles continued to produce the entire long missive that was written by the translators to the readers, if you just read it, and it's available online, it's normally not produced in King James Bibles anymore, but if you'd read it, they say everything you would need to know to reject King James onlyism. They talk about the fact they engage in textual criticism. They talk about the use of the Greek Septuagint. Many King James only folks don't even believe the Greek Septuagint existed at the time of Christ. They say Origen created. They talk about the need for further editing. And
wait, they deny this. That was quick. They deny the legitimacy of Septuagint. They say Origen created that. Is that part of their view?
Yes. Oh, yes. That's look at Ruckman's writings. His stuff has been picked up by many.
Okay, that surprises me. I wonder what they thought Paul was using then, because Origen came after Paul.
Just a little bit, but you're assuming that these folks actually know a lot about history, which in general the vast majority of them do not.
Yeah.
This is a traditional belief. It's a belief that it allows you to paint a wide variety of modern scholars as a bunch of Christ-denying liberals. And since there are a lot of Christ-denying liberal scholars, it's easy just to paint everybody in that and make it a black-and-white issue and here, use this, and this is all the questions go away.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the original King James that was published had thousands of notes in the column about variant readings and various translations and things like that. The majority of King James translations produced today, published today, don't have those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people look at their Bibles and they see those teeny tiny little font footnotes, which now that I'm past 45 years of age, I can't even read anymore anyways, but,
I have the same problem.
Yeah, and so no, there's no longer any textual variation in the New Testament after you pass 45, but those little footnotes bother people. They don't like to hear that some manuscripts say this and some manuscripts say that, and therefore it's easier to just simply lay all of that at the foot of Christ-denying liberal scholarship than it is to actually do the hard work you need to do to find out why we can trust the New Testament why it's the Word of God and how we can defend that. The one thing is for awful sure, if you raise your child in King James onlyism and send them off to Bart Ehrman's class, they're doomed.
Oh, yeah, you make that point.
Yeah, King James onlyism is the most certain way to make sure that your young people will be the best setups for anybody who knows anything about textual criticism or its history when they get into the public arena.
Yeah,
it's absolutely indefensible.
That is really sad. Let me ask you one more question. We're almost out of time here. We're talking with James White, author of The King James Only Controversy, Can You Trust Modern Translations? And I've said it's really a great read and a lot of fascinating stuff in there. This is a question I've heard before. You address it in your book, and we just got like 2 minutes here, but do we have the unadulterated Word of God? And if so, where is it? I mean, this is what they ask. How is it that God preserves His Word? From what it looks like, He hasn't preserved His Word if there are all these variations. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, if we don't understand what preservation is about and how God did it, then we're really going to be confused on this issue. You can preserve a word by, for example, chiseling it on the wall of a cave someplace, mm-hmm. and then not letting anybody in but one high priest every 20 years to make sure that we still have the right copies.
Mm-hmm.
That would be one way of doing it, and a fairly effective way of doing it, but that's not how God chose to do it. God preserved His Word not by using photocopiers to pass it down to us, but by making sure that in the very first generations there was an explosion, a proliferation mm-hmm. of copies of the New Testament all across the known world. See, what I like to do is, a lot of my work over the past number of years has been in Islam. I've been debating most of the leading Islamic apologists. And I like to utilize what happened with the Quran as a good counterexample. Around 650, 655 or so, Uthman, the third caliph, according to Islamic sources anyways, collects the Quran and produces an authorized version of the Quran,
mm-hmm.
which he copies and sends to the major cities in the Islamic Empire, and then he orders everything that existed before that to be burned. Now, this edition of the Quran is protected by the sword. It has the backing of the government itself, and as a result, the vast majority of manuscripts that we have are very, very much alike. Mm-hmm. They are all copies of the Uthmanic Quran. The problem is, you have to trust that Uthman got it absolutely positively right.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go back beyond him because he destroyed what he was working with. And so when you have an official version created, you have to trust the people that produced it perfectly. There was no Christian Uthman. There was never a time when Pope, Council, or anybody else
mm-hmm.
actually controlled the text of the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
It was immediately copied widely. Multiple authors writing to multiple audiences from multiple locations at multiple times. There was never a time when anyone could collect it up and do what the enemies of the Christian faith always say was done.
So if I could sum this up, then it's like, because of the massive number of manuscripts that we have, it keeps that kind of thing from happening that happened with the Muslims, and it allows us now at this point to look and see and discover that there is a, using textual criticism, we can reproduce the text with a high degree of confidence and know that we have a representation of the original where we wouldn't have had that on any other system.
Exactly. That is the mechanism of preservation, is through the massive proliferation of the text, not through the production of a single text and then the protection of that by like a priestly class or something like that.
Well, James, thank you so much for spending some of your Sunday with us. The book is great. It's the King James Only Controversy. This is the second edition. There's a lot of new stuff here compared to the last one. It's a great contribution to our scholarship and to our ability to defend the truth.
Thanks, Greg. Been great to be with you.
All the best to you, James. James White, The King James Only Controversy, Can You Trust Modern Translations? I have two copies now. Everyone should have one copy at least, this new one, in their library. And this will help you to chart the development of the Scripture, the development of textual criticism, and especially to answer the challenges of those who are King James Only advocates. Well, that's it for our show, ladies and gentlemen. Our special homework this week, go to our website. The article is on pluralism with all the religious differences. Listen, we can't all be right. Maybe we both are wrong. All are wrong, but we can't all be right. That's what I discussed there on that piece on pluralism. Go ahead and give it a read, and I will be back next time with you. Thank you for joining me today. Go out and give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcast and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.